Okay, welcome to episode 62 of Strike and Mike. What's up, Striker?
Hey, how you doing, everyone?
We have a guest joining us on the program today. We can call him Ahab. I believe that's what he said. Not Ishmael, but Ahab.
That's right. How you guys doing?
Is that your correct pronoun, Ahab?
Yes.
It is. Yeah. Ahab is, but I looked it up and I was thinking of the Moby Dick character. But then I looked and he's this Jewish king from the Bible. And of course, and I was like, oh, man, maybe that wasn't the best choice, but too late now.
Well, whoa. Whatever. I mean, you know, don't matter. A lot of Europeans have biblical names. So, you know, Michael is a biblical name as well. There you go.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yep. As is so, John and a ton of others.
And Eric the Red, he was a famous Jewish king, right? Eric the Red.
No, Eric is actually a Nordic name.
Oh, no. I guess that's right.
Eric is actually a pure Aryan name. No Jewish influence there. But speaking of Aryans, let's talk about the true Aryans. I'm joking, of course.
The land of the Aryans.
Yes, the original homeland of the Aryan race. But in all reality, let's talk about. I want to talk about Iran and the recent maneuvers that the United States has been the escalation, the saber rattling, if you will. Why it's happening? Because the mainstream media just is totally negligent in covering this, and also then the Israel Gaza stuff. So I guess we could start with Iran. So a couple nights ago, John Bolton, I believe it was Monday night, John Bolton comes out and he said, or Sunday night, John Bolton comes out and he's like, oh, we're putting a carrier group, another carrier group in the Persian Gulf. Now, as it turns out, I did some research on this, and a lot of people, after we talked about it yesterday on Tedious, some people messaged me that know more about military stuff and you know, the assets of the U.S. Navy and the maneuvers and things like that. And they were saying, in fact, this was a routine maneuver. The announcement was meant to be the saber rattling, but they're not really doing they're not adding extra assets. So this aircraft carrier Stennis is moving out of the Persian Gulf back to the United States, and this Abraham Lincoln group is moving in, but they're announcing it as if it's in response to some kind of Iranian aggression. And of course the issue is about the Straits of Hormuz and the oil corridor out of the Persian Gulf by Oman and all of that, and this is a very strategic route because it's how oil is exported. And Bolton said that openly the U.S.'s goal is to reduce Iran's oil exports to zero. Now, why the hell would we want to do that? And they're claiming that it's because there's a threat of Iran against U.S. assets, but that's just, I mean, there's no reason to believe that. Then we find out yesterday that this supposed threat assessment was based on intelligence given to them by, guess who? We all know, the Israelis.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, it's all a bunch of bullshit, and the whole thing is just like, they're just waving, they're just saber rattling at Iran for literally no reason, and then they're talking about how the Iranians, how dare they, are making moves to pull out of parts of the nuclear deal. Because remember, there was European countries involved in that deal and Iran, and then the U.S. pulled out unilaterally because Trump wanted to kiss the ass of, you know, Zionist Jews. And why shouldn't Iran? On what grounds does the U.S. have to complain about Iran pulling out of it?
And what do we get out of this? I mean,
The American people get nothing. Zero. Yeah, zilch. So,
you know, there's about $175 billion in export revenue that are being lost, even with the limited amount of business done between 1995 and 2012 with Iran. That's someone estimated that's about 65,000 to 70,000 jobs a year are lost in the United States thanks to this ridiculous antagonistic approach towards them. Furthermore, the price of gasoline. I mean, it's actually getting to be – seeing what's happening in Libya and Venezuela, it's realistic to think that we might have $100 barrel of gas by next year.
We're already over $3 a gallon in most parts of America now.
It's interesting that they're trying to. I didn't hear that about them. What was it? Did Bolton said that they're trying to reduce the oil exports to
Yeah,
to zero?
You said the ultimate goal is to reduce their exports to zero. Like, why does anybody care about that? Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, isn't that what happened? I mean, the cutting off the oil is how they got Japan to do Pearl Harbor.
Yes,
I mean,
they blockaded
economic strangulation. And see, you know, it's funny because I had a discussion over the weekend with a very good friend of mine about this idea that boycott, economic boycott, is something that is like one of the primary, the whole Anglo-Jewish world order. This was their big method that they used against Germany in World War I, and not a lot of people know about that.
Yeah.
How many Germans, like children, starved to death, at the end of the war, World War I, and immediate aftermath. The boycott, the blockade against Germany,
and the hypocrisy.
They strangled Germany out. The hypocrisy, yeah.
The hypocrisy of these maneuvers, they blockade them, and then they're like, well, they attacked our ships.
Right.
You're blockading them.
That's the same thing in World War II. Yeah. In World War II, it was the hunger plan and all that. They're trying to starve out slobs. No, the idea was we cannot have our civilian population starving from economic blockade. We have to make that a priority. Now, you look at what they do with individuals. So many people in this movement that I talk to, the reason why they can't be more active, and basically why they can't exercise their right to free speech and free expression, is because of economic consequences, boycott of their livelihood. So this is why they freak out when the Nazis organize a one-day boycott of Jewish businesses. Goebbels organized – it was a single day. And they're like, oh, the SA blockaded – one day of them in 1933, mm-hmm. and they say, oh
– Jews around the world – blocking German exports in Europe and the United States. That was retaliation.
Look at how they react to BDS.
BDS, that was what I was going to say. BDS scares the shit out of them. More than almost, I think on our side, sometimes we're like, they still have so much money. Why are they so scared by that? Because it's their primary – if you're a plutocrat, if you are a capitalist, and if you're a Jew international money man, and your primary method of pressuring people is with money power, mm-hmm. when someone uses that tactic against you, you get very scared because you're so used to using it against somebody else. So they're trying to do what they did to Japan, strangle them or force them to provoke them into a fight so that they can have a new war in the Middle East.
There's an argument that they're putting targets out there for the Iranians.
Oh yeah.
So that they're basically like, here, we're going to blockade the Strait of Hormuz, and here's some nice ships for you to shoot at.
Right.
But then they can start a war. Now there's reasons why a war with Iran would be actually disastrous that I want to talk about in a second. But the boycott angle is interesting because they freak out over BDS. I mean, Morty Klein of ZOA, Zionist Organization of America, ZOA. At that white nationalism hearing in front of Congress, he kind of derailed the whole thing because, the ADL lady she's like, look, guy, we're here to complain about white nationalists, not BDS, not Palestinians. But he derailed the whole thing complaining about BDS, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
It turned the whole thing kind of into a farce, which was great because it was a farce. But, they're still freaked out about it. And other thing is they legitimize this tactic. As here's something that it's always legitimate to refuse to do business. It's always legitimate to boycott and protest through that, through a peaceful, legitimate protest method. But then you do it to Jews, and all of a sudden they're passing laws against it.
Right.
Totally violate the First Amendment.
Last week when Tucker had some guy on talking about the deplatforming of Louis Farrakhan and P.J. Watson and so on, they had some libertarian guy, an honest libertarian, not a phony one. And this guy went on and he's like, the people that are coming next are not going to be, Ben Shapiro. The people that are next down the list of the censorship are going to be BDS people. Because that's like the second most demanded target for censorship. Now you have to it begs a question. Why? What does that say about the people censoring it? Is it because they're motivated by liberal Democratic Party partisanship, or is it just that they're Jews and Jews don't believe in free speech and want to destroy criticism, whether it's from the right or the left?
Yeah, and the very idea that you could refuse to do business with them, that you could put economic pressure on them, that you could pressure institutions. Now, they don't have the power. Like, they always get these things that happen on these campuses where these radical left students vote do one of the useful things that they do, which is they vote for BDS. They vote for the university to divest. And then the board is just like, nah. Because the board is all Jews, right? And or they just take right, so much Jewish money that they're like, if we were to do this, like our donor base would dry up because basically we've allowed ourselves to become completely, you know, slaves of Jews and to Jewish money. I mean, these Ivy League institutions in particular. So in a way, this has become a big thorn in their side. But they it's embarrassing when they have to expose themselves. And so then you get, you know, and again, remember we talked several months ago, we talked about the moron Kevin McCarthy. You know, the Republican minority leader in the House who comes out and he's like, I just think it's disgusting and against all American values to boycott Israel. Like, really? Really?
Can
Why?
Can you guys believe that Trump was the one who stood on that debate stage in South Carolina and said what he said about they lied. There were no weapons of mass destruction and they knew there were no weapons
and he
of
said
mass
destruction.
When he said that,
Jeb Bush's face. That,
My father was in the hospital recovering from some pretty serious surgery at that time, and we watched it because we'd watched all the debates at that point, and we watched it together in the hospital, and it was and we were both like cheering because Trump more forcefully denounced the Iraq war than John Kerry ever had, than Barack Obama ever did, and it was incredible that same guy could appoint. I mean, just enough time has gone by here that a lot of these younger guys don't remember John Bolton, what a fucking devil that guy was. I mean, John Bolton, for Trump to appoint John Bolton, it's one of these things that we accept it as normal. But if you just stop and think about that, I mean, that guy in Trump's administration, I mean, that's a huge indication of something very, very wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, something is very, very wrong.
It was truly remarkable. The thing that was remarkable about that moment is that Trump was talking about the Iraq war the way normal people talked about it. Because politicians would always talk about it in this very evasive and stilted way, right? They would evade. They know. Everyone knows it was bullshit, right? And so they would talk about – I remember the thing there was – it was an intelligence flap. There was an intelligence flap. It was like it was a big – it was a mistake. We made a big mistake. Boo-boo. Whoops.
Yeah, yeah. He even said that. He said you can make mistakes. He said, but that was a beauty, you know?
He talked the way normal people talk. I mean, for my whole life since that war, normal people weren't talking about it. But yeah, there's a bunch of lies. Bullshit. Like, they just lied. Like, everyone says Democrats, Republicans, everybody knows this. And so just ordinary people, that's how they talk. And so he just said it. And, man, they brought him to heel. I don't know what it was that they did. I don't even like speculating on this anymore. But,
yeah. I mean, I feel like Trump maybe just, you know, this is what I've been saying about Trump for a while, is that he spots a good deal. And when he was running, and I've said this a number of times to people, when he was running in 2000 to try to control the Reform Party, he was running up against Pat Buchanan and Buchanan's Buchanan brigades who had come over from the Republican Party, and they were, you know, being tagged as white nationalists. And that's how Trump described Buchanan. He said, oh, he's a Hitler lover. He doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays. He's an extremist. I can't imagine why anybody would vote for him. And then he gets his ass handed to him. And it was the only political defeat that Trump has ever suffered. Was he was not able to get control of the Reform Party. He didn't stand a chance against Buchanan's people, who were a lot of them white nationalists, who were very motivated. And I think Trump, who's very good at spotting a good deal, sort of an undervalued property, that he can turn it around. He thought, this is this huge untapped support base in American politics that no one is buying it. And the rest of the system, they're like, oh, you can't do that. That's toxic. That's the Pandora's box. You open that up, which in was.
I'm critical of Pat Buchanan because of his temperament, but you know, he had a way of tying in different economic issues and social issues to the pro-white cause self-defense.
He was,
so I do admire him for that. But
he was an economic nationalist. I mean, when he was running in 1992, he was running on a campaign, an isolationist, anti-war and anti-free trade campaign. Like, he was running on that.
In 2000, I mean, his policy was basically, it was three things. It was immigration. It was ending the foreign wars. And it was ending this free trade bullshit. And basically, Trump just lifted that. I mean, Trump was a liberal in a lot of ways. And all of a sudden, he comes along with these talking points that are straight out of – but my point is that he saw an untapped source of power there that he thought, I can use this to power me to the White House. And what's happening right now – I mean, again, I don't know. I'm not convinced that this is the case, but it's plausible. Trump now is just making the calculus, and a number of other people have said this, that I don't need them anymore. And Trump has no problem with and we've seen this over and over again, Chris Christie. We're basically like Chris Christie. We're like the people that came along, supported him early, and then the Jew says, oh, you know, by the way, I don't like that guy. And he's like, okay, I'll kick him to the curb because I don't need him anymore. I got the nomination.
I mean,
one thing I'll say,
establishment now. He's got the establishment backing.
Yeah, that's the movie he's making.
One thing I'll say about white populism in general is that it's very important to see the systematic causes of white genocide, which, you know, part of it is economic, part of it is social. There's the war aspect, and so tying all of this together. I mean, think of it this way: if borders are broken down for markets, what's stopping them from being broken down for people, right? So they would just present this as an evolution of the market. I mean, I was watching a documentary about Alan Greenspan yesterday, and this guy's whole thing, I mean, he was an accolade of Ayn Rand, and he
was one
of
these. You mean Elisa Rosenbaum?
Yeah, that whole circle is just bunch of Jews, but his whole thing was he actually was able to convince Bill Clinton to support these experiments in Asia, where they're basically using American military and economic pressure to force the South Koreans and the Thais into completely liberalizing and privatizing their markets. That led to a huge influx of American Jewish capital into these countries, which then led to the Asian market crisis in the 90s. So the point I'm making here is, you know, this was kind of like the test case, the test balloon, but Alan Greenspan was fundamental in reforming the American economy so that nation states and sovereignty are no longer even on the table. Now it's considered to be a fascist idea to even believe in borders. So making sure to make a case that ties the economic nationalism with the race nationalism, with the cultural nationalism, that's very important. And that's something that Pat Buchanan was very prescient about in the 90s when NAFTA and neoliberalism and all these other experiments were first coming into the laboratory and being put to the test, you know. So that was why he was effective. Trump came much later after the effects were felt.
Yeah, right. And they, right, you know, they can sense it when you start talking about things like erecting trade barriers. They immediately assume you also want to erect racial barriers, national barriers. And you're like, well, yeah, I do. You know, which is not to say that trade between nations is, it can't happen, but it's got to be done. It can't be done on this like what they want essentially is a leveling of markets worldwide. And if you even go back to economists like David Ricardo, where he talks about relative advantage or whatever his theory was, where he's like, hey, you know, if this region of the world is best at producing this, they should be the producers, and then it levels the whole world. But I don't want to be leveled with the world. I don't want to be same, dragged down to their level.
It's the same strategy with unions. I mean, the idea of a union. Right now, we have this bullshit, not right to work, but at will employment, where now we've put the employee and the employer on an equal footing. So if you, let's say you work for Amazon, at will employment. So you're on equal footing.
Equal parties,
so
legally.
In other words, Amazon, if they want to fire you for any reason at all, they can, and if you want to quit them for any reason at all, you can. So therefore, you're on equal footing. I mean,
what do you have to complain about, Goy?
Yeah, the whole point of a union, collective bargaining, is the common worker does not have the economic power that the CEO and the stockholders do. So all the workers together pool together their little itty bitty strength. And now they have the force to demand. And that's why, you know, it's interesting because this has been in the news a lot, how wages are still kind of, I mean, they're rising a little bit, but for the level that unemployment's at. And I heard a report on this on the news recently where they were talking about it's because unions are really weak right now. There's no organized labor. So we're not in a position, workers are not in a position to demand the things that they could be demanding.
Yeah.
This all happened with Reagan and breaking the back of American labor on the, the aircraft traffic controllers strike?
Yeah, the PATCO
this
union.
Has been, yeah, but it's also women in the workforce because women in the workforce doubled the labor pool. and immigration. If it's not the one, it's the other.
Yeah.
So you can't order it. Now, the same strategy, though, they're using around the world when it comes to everything. The same strategy of breaking people down into component individual parts. It's the same with the family unit, that where the if the mother is working, if she has to go and buy her own house and then she gets the kids some of the time and then the father has to have his own house, they both have to be on the treadmill 100%, unless if they are together, they're married together, she stays home and raises the kids. You don't need to have pay for fucking, daycare or something like that. You can keep your costs down. You can invest, you can pay off your home. I mean, the whole idea of groups banding together, whether it be a family unit, a union, anywhere, and this is what you're talking about when you talk about nations and nation states. It's a nation state, a unit that holds together, can then negotiate and is in a stronger position. And if it's broken down, it is not in the position to resist.
The straw man argument they would make is that you need women in the workplace and you need mass immigration because you need to fill these job positions. But then what I would say is that, well, people used to have 100 years ago, they used to have 5, 6, sometimes 10 children. So you lose that when you have women in the workforce because they have children later or not at all.
Right.
And you also lose it with mass immigration because wages drop. So you end up also kind of being in the same spot. If you were to have a population that was virile and you had many children, you would have the workers you need for your economy.
And the thing with that is that, yeah, there's also the dual effect of immigration, of the racial and cultural incoherence, which then leads people don't want to have children because, you know, they don't know where their kids are going to be going to school.
Like the Tower of Babel. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
if you look at, like, in New York City, is for whites, at least New York City is the least fertile place on earth. I don't know of any. I mean, the white people having children in New York City is like not, it just doesn't happen. And part of that is the expense of living there. And part of that is then white people want to send their children to nice schools and they can't do that in New York City because who are you sending them to school with? And that's another effect of immigration. So the racial effect and then the integration of schools is another thing. So a lot of whites conclude like, well, there's no comfy place for my kids. Like when you think of a white community, of a cohesive white community that holds together and sticks together, has a school, has a town square, the whole thing like that. Like you don't mind having kids. You don't have to supervise them every minute of the day because they're not in any danger. The community picks up the slack. Like when I was everyone talks, oh, when I was a kid, blah, blah, but it's actually true. When I was a kid, you know, there's an interesting thing you can look at. There was a thing, I think it was even The Guardian, maybe it was the BBC, they did the radius from the home that parents allow children by generation. And like three generations ago, parents would let their kids roam free, go into the woods, explore, you know, wherever. Then one generation ago, people would let their kids ride their bike around town, you know, walk around town, ride their bike around town. Yeah. And then this generation, they don't let their kids go down to the corner.
Yeah.
And that's part of its diversity. It really is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we got to look at all that as a whole, but we kind of digress from the Middle East to that. But like, I think that's
Gaza?
Important. The other thing I'll say about the economy, because there was some good economic, I do want to just talk about the economy real quick, because there was good, now that we're on it, there was good economic numbers that came out supposedly. Now, there's a problems with these numbers. A, they talk about low unemployment, really low unemployment. And then they talk about low unemployment for women. Now, typically, Trump always does his bit of blacks, Hispanics, whatever. But then they're really touting the women unemployment numbers. Now, women unemployment numbers means just less kids. So, of course, we need immigration then, right? And that's the argument that's going to be made. But then on top of that, I'll actually agree that there are jobs out there. You can find you can find work, but you find, like, temp work. You can find gigs, right? Like the gig
$12
economy,
an
right?
hour.
Yeah, you can find and for one day.
12 if you're lucky.
But then but then it's not even permanent. Like there's companies now where stores, like individual stores, retail stores, will hire people on a day-to-day basis. And white people can do this too now. I mean, this used to be a thing, day laborers were Mexican illegals. Now it's white people are doing day labor. And there's companies where you can go online. And look, you can find the work. I'm not saying you can't, but it doesn't pay well, and it's not secure. So it's like you can work 8 hours tomorrow at, you know, $9.50 an hour, whatever it might be. But you got to travel to the place where you're going to work. Travel costs is on you. and it's one day's worth of work. What do you know? You're going to walk away at the end of the day, $50.
I think people, like a year ago, I remember this was true, that consumer debt was at an all-time high.
Yeah.
Revolving debt.
Yeah.
And if you look at right now, there are I know this was true like a month ago, that there were more people than there has been in like ever who are more than three payments late or three payments late with their car payments, which they said that that's a really creepy number. Like that indicates something is wrong. Yeah. You know, I mean, people, you know, another thing we were talking about with economics is like something like a family home. You know, the idea that you pay off your home and then it stays in the family and then a family and you can build wealth instead of this constant refinancing and constant, you know, splitting off and moving around. But it's this, you know, somebody said this, that we no longer have a middle class in this country. We have a working class, a lower class financing a middle class lifestyle through debt. And this is the thing that I wonder, you know, would be a real sign of progress if people are paying off homes, or if they're starting families, or if they're, you know, actually building wealth in the poor or the working and the middle class, instead of just, you know, being able to buy more shit, you know, on credit or whatever. And yeah, you're not going to be able to do any of those things on $12 an hour. You're just not.
Think of how powerful it is as a method of control.
You're
in debt. You got the water coming up to your neck. And, you know, if you say something politically incorrect, you lose your job, then you're fucked.
Nobody knows this more than we do.
So, like, E. Michael Jones actually makes a really interesting point about this, where he talks about how debt is just a way for oligarchs to steal your labor.
Right.
So when inflation surpasses the rise in wages, then you start seeing more and more usury. You start seeing more and more debt. And he actually traces this in his book throughout history. He traces it in Venice. He traces it in the United States in the present day and so on. And the fact that you need to have a credit card to buy a car or buy your own home, that's very new. That wasn't happening in the 50s and 60s when usually there was just one breadwinner. So now with two breadwinners, you can't buy a house.
A very dear friend of mine, we were going to hang out, a bunch of us, recently, and he said he couldn't because he had to wage cuck. And I joked with him. I was like, well, why don't you quit your job? You know, come on out. And he made the joke. He said, oh, yeah, the wonders of capitalism. Quit your job, and within 1 month, you lose everything. You know, that's it. Your life is like every, you know. Yeah. So this is the level of freedom we have in this country right now.
And so you also have, I mean, when it comes to some of these numbers, there's a racial element there too, where certainly blacks and Hispanics are going to be, they're going to be worse off than whites. But whites are, if you look at numbers relatively by year, and this can also go with like family formation. So we talk about blacks and how they are very bad at family formation. So like 80% of blacks are illegitimate, but in the 1960s, like 30% of blacks were illegitimate, and now today 30% of whites are illegitimate. So these numbers and the economy goes the same way. So blacks are always going to be hit first because they are who they are. So they're going to be the first that aren't making their payments. Okay. And they're very bad at making payments. We all get that. But like white people are now catching up to where blacks were like 50 years ago. So they're like, I don't want to use a word, but they're kind of niggerifying the white population.
Well, in one sense, that's a good thing for certain kind of working class whites from this perspective. I had this realization the other day when I was thinking about student loans and when people are paying off their student loans. And I thought, because I read some data on it, and the people that default, and they're like, defaults disproportionately affect black people, non-whites, minorities. And I thought, think about that. I can't tell you how many white people I know who are making student loan payments and have made the excuse that, you know, oh, well, I really can't afford to start a family yet, or we can't have kids.
Yep.
And I thought how this is actually, I mean, this is the juice for you, okay? You have this thing where everybody has this crushing debt. Now, the blacks and the high time preference people We say, you know, you look down on them and say, oh, you know, they're so incompetent. The conservative would say, oh, they're not responsible. They're irresponsible and stupid. They just default on their debts and have kids out of wedlock and reproduce.
Us good white people, look at how good we are.
Yeah, look at when the responsible thing to do is to just wait because you can't afford to have kids. Work, and pay down your debt. So what happens
we're good clients of the Jews.
Yeah, slow time preference, the most low time preference, high IQ, responsible, hardworking whites are literally liquidating themselves with birth control and things like that because, oh, honey, we can't afford it. We have too many loan payments to make. And the money that you're paying those loans on is going to Jewish banks. So, like, not only have the Jews figured out this thing where – the Untermenschen are default going to outbreed then the white, like, normal people who are the most responsible people, the best whites from a standpoint of racially. But then the Jews are profiting on this self-liquidation of the white race.
And you see the usury creeping into smaller and smaller aspects of the economy. There's something called Affirm. And this is a company that loans you, like, $200 for a pair of sneakers.
Dude, never do that.
At a 30% APR.
The APR is like 1,000%, dude. It's like the interest. It's like literally.
It's run by Max Levchin.
I mean, this is payday loan shit, right? They actually made them illegal in New York State. And other states have made them illegal as well, where you will borrow small amounts of money at unbelievably exorbitant, and they're all run off of Indian reservations, but you know that there's a Jew behind it.
Yeah, Max Levchin, just 20 years ago, a black guy could buy his J's right out of pocket.
Well,
he could buy some Uptowns right out of pocket, or, you know, there would be other means of getting them.
they would find other methods of a procuring item.
Yeah, but now they go to the store and they buy a pair of $150 sneakers.
Or they just flash mob the store. I actually like it when I see that shit. I'm like, go for it. Do it. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
It's funny. I find it hilarious.
Why is that form of theft illegal but not this one with Affirm? Okay, because now every time you try to buy clothes on the internet, you get a little option in the corner. It's like, why don't you buy it with Affirm? You can buy it. Pay like $30 a month.
That's the other thing is that, like, understandably, black people are less intelligent and higher time preference than whites. Like, we have to, obviously, that's just true.
Yeah. Are they less intelligent, though? I mean, when they're reproducing, not because of our fucking student loan payments. Well, how do you define intelligence?
This is a deeper conversation, which is what is the actual measure of IQ, and is this a measure of fitness, or is this a measure of your ability to be a cog in this machine? Now, the one thing I'll say, though, about blacks is blacks are not out-reproducing whites. That's not true.
No.
Hispanics are out-producing both. Whites actually out-reproduce blacks by a tiny percentage, and Hispanics out-produce both by a lot.
I thought whites are declining and blacks are like stable.
Last I looked, blacks have been stable for a while and whites are declining. In 2007, it's amazing because I was looking at this now this is stats that I found so people could take issue with them or not. But in 2007, the white birth rate was 2.02 per woman, which is actually above replacement level, which I was quite surprised by. It is now 1.89. And blacks are 1.84.
Oh, wow.
And Hispanics are like 2.5, something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was.
That's still the 1.8 number is still higher than in most Western countries, actually.
Yeah, it actually remarkably is. And I was looking at this, and remember we were talking about Eastern Europe striker, and the numbers are very bleak. I was amazed that, like, Poland is like 1.32. And I was like, holy shit. And
I'm shocked by that.
Yeah, and Hungary is like 1.58. So even though these countries are based, and I do like what some of those governments are doing, I think the governments need to do. You know, they should protect their borders. They should not. It's certainly with birth rates like that, they do not need migrants. It's just going to mess everything up. But they need to start attracting their people back. Their own people, Polish people that are in Western Europe working on day labor jobs. They need to be attracted back to Poland. Hungarians that are doing the same need to be attracted back to Hungary and have children. And then, like, you know, that will be a completion of the nationalist policies of these governments. because like this is a big problem.
It's never going to happen because those countries are increasingly dependent on remittances.
Well, that's the other thing. They're dependent on remittances, and then they're going to ultimately, the way they're going to try and break them is through EU development loans and things like that, through to the government, so the government apparatus can keep functioning, and then the price of that is flood your country with migrants and all the other crap. So, you know, I think it's good to have Viktor Orban is a mixed bag. All these people are mixed bags. You can't ever be like these are perfect, but you can't be they're totally scumbags either. I think that some of these people, their heart might be in the right place. But there's also a lot of pressures that these countries are facing that are just crazy. And yeah, the actual, I was surprised at how fertile whites in the U.S. were. It was a little bit white pilling to see that. But then there's also issues where they're playing around with the definition of white. And this is a thing that Jews have talked about doing, how they, when you tell whites in the U.S. about the coming plurality status of whites, the less than 50% status, then white people start getting alarmed and become more nationalist, more racialist. They don't like this. And so they've started to, we did a whole piece on Tedious about this where I read some article by this Jewish psychologist that was recommending not telling white people or telling white people that mixed race white, like mulattoes are white, essentially. Put mulattoes in the white. It is not true.
Like the UNC shooter.
Yeah. And it's just not true. Like they are, if you're going to give them one race, they're far more likely to identify as black. I mean, half black, half white people identify as black. I mean, they just do. That's how it is. And they're not white. And so when you tell white people that they're white, you're lying, and you're lying because you don't want to alarm white people about their own decline. So, you know, this is clearly a psyop. So I don't know to what extent these stats are influenced by that, but still,
well, it depends. Hold on. It depends. If the whites are defending themselves and Western civilization, then no one's white. But then if they want to pump up the, prison stats or some other thing like that, or they want to create a racial pogrom around George Zimmerman, then even he's white.
That's how the media operates, but I think the people that track this stuff on a statistical level, on a census level, they're a little bit they're less ideological about it, but then, as I said, Jews are breathing down their necks to change how they operate because they don't like the fact that, you know, for example, one of these articles we read on this, the Jews convinced the U.S. Census Bureau, or they convinced, they told them, they ordered them, to stop telling white people about their own decline because it was creating the shift to the right, or the right.
I have noticed that there's been a lot, much fewer articles like that. Mm-hmm. You know, just a couple of years ago, you would see articles every day that would say, oh, the white population is being disseminated into nothing. And this is a great thing. Let's embrace the glorious future.
Now they put out articles like
now
that.
Now they don't do that.
Was one earlier. There was one last week. It was in the Houston Chronicle.
I saw it. Made the rounds on
Twitter. Yeah. But that wasn't like, this is a great thing. That was the, like, white nationalists need to give up. Their cause is lost. There's nothing. It wasn't even like telling you, isn't it going to be a great multicultural future? It was just like, this is how it is. This is what's happening. Right. Just give up now, white racial. But my thing is, I don't believe that. I have moved to the position now that we will. That they are correct. There will be a white plurality on the North American continent, but white racial survival on the North American continent no longer depends upon controlling the borders of the United States. Obviously, we don't have the ability to do that right now, so we have to control ourselves.
Interesting. There was a guy called Farhad Manjoo.
Yes, he works for the New York Times.
This guy wrote a,
interestingly enough, he's not a Manjoo. He's like a Pajit.
Yeah, and this guy was saying that what they've been saying about Western countries, from Australia to Germany to whatever, Argentina to Britain, whatever, that they constantly talk about the how these countries are losing their European majorities. But at the same time, this guy Manjoo is saying that to simply affirm what they've been saying for years is, quote, racist and misogynistic, and it holds that white people face existential decline. So if you say that the argument is racist, well, what are the facts then? We can't even agree on the facts, because if you simply affirm the facts that they put out, but you make it a political issue, then they say, oh, no, that's a racist conspiracy theory. Is it?
Well, it's just like the thing of white. I mean, white is a social construct, yet there's white privilege. You are privileged for being white. I mean, right. it's just a power thing. It's when they, you know, that's one thing Tucker's good. He's like, this is all about power. And in a way, he's right. I mean, it is and it isn't, you know, just about. This game of when it's to their advantage, they'll play these things up, and when it isn't, they won't. I did see that same article, and it really was it was kind of – how about Ilhan Omar recently just saying
This won't be a country for white people.
This isn't
going to
be the country of white people anymore.
Well, then where can white people live, right? Like that's the – I mean now Ilhan, she's a stupid – you know, she's just – she is what she is. I mean she's useful for her anti-Zionist rhetoric, which is great for creating – for sort of jamming the Jewish issue in Washington with lobbying and stuff. But then she's clearly anti-white in her rhetoric. And it's like when you come out and say that, and now the funny thing is when you hear her say that, because she's getting like applause lines where she's like, this won't be a country of hate. And everyone cheers. And then she's like, this won't be a country of white people. And the crowd's like, you know, because it's all white people in the crowd. It's all these Minnesota liberals. So, you know, it's like, you know, you kind of can't have it both ways. Now, what I always tell people, because a lot of people go down the rabbit hole.
One more thing. Okay. Le Monde in France ran a piece also declaring that non-Europeans were replacing Frenchmen. And they actually published a retraction saying, no, actually, it's not even true. We're actually very far away from a replacement. So,
well, that's because they got scared. I mean, they have more reason to be scared than even the U.S. government.
Oh yeah,
because the Yellow Vest is clearly a nascent white movement. Okay, it obviously is.
All forms of white populism,
and there are open. I mean, there are clear ideological, you know, white nationalists or for France, whatever you would call that, French nationalists in that crowd. They're not all as woke as that, but there are that element is there, and it's further influencing them, which is why Antifa attempts to go out in the street and like ambush these people and like beat them up in front of other people to humiliate them. It doesn't usually work, but they've tried it several times. But yeah, so what I always say to people when they see these arguments where the definition of race, as Hitler said, you know, you attempt to grasp it and it slips through your fingers and then gathers again underneath. Right. It's that's how they treat the definition of race. And so I'd always say, like, look, if you believe that – if these people really believed that there was no such thing as race, they wouldn't come after only you. They would go after colleges that use race-based admissions. They would go after employers that use racial quotas. And don't tell me for a second that they don't. So if they really believed it, they would go after people with institutional power that use race as a criteria in selecting against whites, whether it be employers or whether it be universities.
And if they really believed in liberalism, they wouldn't be embracing identitarianism for non-whites.
Right.
I mean, that's something that
but
that
only
they're
in
very
a weaponized
about.
In a weaponized way. Now, since
it's not real identitarianism, because the real like black identitarians like Louis Farrakhan get banned just like we do.
Yes,
and guys, what about taking the idea of this is something that I've toyed with over the years? Is you know we get so hung up. People in this movement get so hung up on trying to define race as biological, and then they come around and they say, "Oh, it's a social construct," and all this. I came across an essay on that that Calvin German propaganda archive page that's from like 1936, and it was the head of the Nazi organization for physicians. So he's a really bright guy, racialist thing. And there was a line I brought it up here, but I thought you guys would find this interesting. He said that. He's talking about the name of the talk is race and population policy. And he's talking about how there are people who criticize their policies from various viewpoints. And he says one is the group of scientists that this group is becoming a lot smaller. But there is still a group of scientists who dispute this and say that it's unscientific. And then he says this. He says another group of scholars and scientists, a group steadily becoming smaller, even abroad, agree with our racial hygiene measures, or he's saying that, that there are others that most agree with our racial hygiene and measures and our genetic policies. But to those that disagree with it, we can only say to these learned critics, our genetic and racial thinking stems in the end not from our scientific, but rather from our National Socialist convictions, and that it was not learned scientists, but rather our Führer Adolf Hitler, and he alone, who made genetic and racial thinking the center of our National Socialist worldview and the foundation of the rebuilding of our people's state. The doctrines of blood and race are not, first of all, an important and interesting piece of biological science to us, but rather, above all else, a political ideological attitude that fundamentally determines our attitudes to things and to the questions of life. I thought that was really interesting. They're saying that this is first and foremost our worldview. And it's determining our, you know, so you can dispute with us, say, oh, who's white? This person's not white. Oh, there is Aryan is just a language group, whatever. But this is a worldview that we have. This isn't you're arguing with a worldview. That's sort of the thing that they say at us. Oh, it's I thought that was an interesting point of view. I mean, that's turning it around and shoving it up their ass in a way that I'm not used to hearing.
Well, I think that's because the thing is, like, you can say, like, with their argument of it's a social construct. Now, I remember when I first started getting out of libertarian thinking and into more interesting kinds of thought, because libertarian thinking it fancies itself as very empirical, scientific, logical, deductive, blah 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 blah, right? But when I started thinking about race and I started approaching it and having had experience as a leftist, I could understand maybe better than some right wingers that were never leftists how leftists think. And I was like, look, you can incorporate their modes of thought into how you think about race. Like, you don't need to run from the social construct idea.
Right.
You don't need to run from that, because now they can. There's basic biological science or whatever, right? And that does show genetic differences, but you can go over. I mean, I remember watching videos years ago about allele clusters and shit, and I was like, I don't care. I know who's white. You know, like, everyone knows who's white. And if you tell me that you don't, I don't believe these people that don't tell me that they don't, because they know who they're attacking. And we decide who's white. There was also an element of we decide who's white. And ultimately, you know, it's also not purely about, like, hatred of the other. That's another important thing. But I do think there's a social aspect to it. Like, there's people that are, like, and people want, and one of the things the enemy wanted to do to us was to get us down an autistic rabbit hole where people will say, like, if your genetic test, and I don't even recommend people get these tests anymore. I got one because, but whatever. But they're like, if your genetic test doesn't come back 99.9% European, like, you're not welcome. I'm like, well, that's retarded. You're really stupid if you say that. And white is, we know what white is. We get to define it. And we're not giving you that power. Because if we admit that we're in an argument with you over what race is and what white is, then we're giving you power to decide. And we're not giving you that power. We're not giving our enemies the power to decide who our group is. So there is a
social... Well, not just that. It's also a disingenuous troll. Because suddenly, if someone has to shoot a black in self-defense, they know exactly who's white.
Of course, like I said, and they know exactly who's white when they need to exclude somebody from Harvard University. They know exactly who's white when they and who's black. I mean, look, everybody knows. Like, I remember Richard Spencer was asked this question when he was at Texas A&M like a couple years ago, and he, you know, and I got asked this question at Auburn too by this broad that was trying to troll me. And they were trying to troll him, and he was like, I know who's white by looking at them. And it's like, that's actually the best answer. Because it doesn't really give them anywhere to run.
The other thing about race is not static. Race is fluid. So when you talk about, you know, race in a it's almost like it's like a capitalist segregationist kind of attitude to say, okay, well, like, now we got to break it down. Who's race? Who's this? Who's not? I think if your worldview is racial, you are not just looking at a snapshot of where you're at, who's white, who's not, and how much are they white, what is white. You're looking at all the ancient forces that have shaped and formed your race as it is now, and you're also, with your political ideological attitude, your values are setting where this race is going to go, how it's going to develop. Because that's the thing, is like you have racial values, cultural values. These things are going to shape the future development of your people in the same way that, and the future direction that your race takes. Because the white race is not going to be what it is today, 10,000 years from now, whether or not we win. You know, I mean, it's going to have a different form. So that's where, you know, racial values and racial thinking, it's a lot more than just, you know, cutting a pie up and dividing it up into this percentage, that percentage, and trying to keep things static along those lines. It's saying we want to take the best elements, reconcentrate them, increase them, develop them. And you can only do that with a worldview. You can't do that with just, well, you know, scientific data.
Another thing, too, is perhaps a better term would be Western or Occidental, in the sense that you understand the different ingredients that went into creating Western civilization, the different peoples, right? You have Latins, right. Slavs, Germanic people, Nordic people, Anglos, whatever. These all kind of contributed in their own unique fashion to what we call the West. I think one key argument that we kind of let pass by under the radar is how they've been able to redefine Westerner as someone who takes up liberal values, which, some of the anti-Muslim stuff sort of reflects that in a bit. And that's why, you know, that's how Jews are able to define that stuff as well. Like whenever you see people fight, I'm not saying all criticisms of Muslims, and I'm definitely not talking about immigration, but I'm talking about like the hardcore counter jihad stuff. Oftentimes, the position from which they criticize it is a liberal one,
to the extent you're allowed to criticize immigration of the other, it has to be from a liberal perspective, attacking Islam for being reactionary
or Judeo-Christian. That's another one that we let that one pass under the radar.
That was the consensus
on the establishment right, the Judeo-Christian value.
It's the Ben Shapiro consensus. I mean, Ben Shapiro was using that, talking about how dare these evil Palestinians shoot down these Judeo-Christians.
You know,
these people with Judeo-Christian values.
I had a thought about the Palestinian thing. You know, they talk about how they're firing rockets out of Gaza and all this. And I said this somewhere else, too. The idea of, can you imagine if out of Auschwitz, some of the Jews like got together and they made some kind of homemade mortar and lobbed one into like a German town nearby.
They did.
And if the Germans came in, you know, and just go in and like kill, you know, 20,000 Jews in Auschwitz extra because, you know, this
extra.
Oh, well, you know, they're right, exactly. But I mean, according to their own narrative is what I'm saying. Yeah. Like even if based on their own narrative,
we're going to do 10,000 today instead of 4,000.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's what Gaza is. It's a concentration camp. It's an
armed
camp.
I'm always amazed when I see standing structures in Gaza. I'm like, how the hell?
Oh, that happened. I'll tell you guys.
Let me tell you something about this latest strike. We could go into the racial things and stuff like that. There's other things to say on this. It's a continuing conversation, race and borders and European and national civic identity versus racial national identity and things like that, and how they've corrupted that and how they tell you, don't be white, be German, but then they make German to be anyone in the state of Germany with papers from the German state. And they did that in America. America is somebody with papers from the U.S. government. And now America is just anybody. They just haven't gotten here yet. But
well, one problem, though, is the post-war developments of the Soviet Union and America becoming the world powers. And those two countries, by a sort of for ideological reasons, you can argue that they are civic structures to an extent.
With America, you can. America kind of is. You can't say
black people are not American.
Arguably, America is not an exclusive white identity. A German certainly is. I mean, French certainly is. But they've corrupted those. They've taken what they did to America.
Exactly.
And really only blacks.
That's because of the outcome of the Second World War.
I would argue that there's still an idea in people's mind that of an American is still like an Aryan-looking white guy that gives you like a firm handshake or whatever, and then they say American blacks, and you have a particular image of what an American black is. But you still don't think of like mestizos and Indios as Americans, even though there's increasingly an image of that as an American. But it is an issue there. But, I mean, like I said, we can talk about this eternally. But I think that one of the reasons they attack white as the thing that... Because, remember, they go after white. Look at everything that they write. White is what they attack. Because they feel confident that they can redefine any state-based national identity as just the people in the boundaries of that state issued citizenship papers by that state, which they've done to America. Now they've done it to Britain. They've done it to Germany. They've done it to France. You know, they're having a harder time with countries like Italy, but they want to do that, but the Italians are resisting. But they can do that. And so they attack white. Because that's not something that you can just say there's no citizenship paper of white. You know, they can't. It is an indelible racial characteristic. So that is what they do want to attack. So that's why they go after anti-white, and that's why I defend on the grounds of white, because that's what's under attack. It's a definite thing. Sure, there's people on the fringes and whatnot, there's edges, but we know what's white, and we know that we're under attack. If we weren't, look at every headline in the media, and tell me why people aren't under attack.
Yeah, you know, it was on the thing of, I'll tell you guys something else. On the thing of what is an American and how, you know, what that was taken to be. If you've ever read H.P. Lovecraft, I have a two-volume set of his writings to Robert E. Howard, the guy that created Conan the Barbarian. And basically, it's from the 1930s, and all they wrote to about each other is race and history, really. I mean, they were both really interested in it, and they were topics of interest of the day. And one of the things Lovecraft describes, he talks about New York, and he talks about how New York at the time was being overrun by Jews. He's like of the greasiest type or something. It's really funny when he describes it. But he says that because he was very he came from old stock Anglo. And he said that this is the line he says. He says that as for the foreign overrunning of America, and again, he, at the time, he's talking about Italians coming in and like Irish. He says, as for the foreign overrunning of America, that is certainly the most tragic event in the continent's history. The very essence of a real civilization is the continuous dwelling of generations on the same soil in the same manner, so that race becomes fitted to landscape and a body of stable, genuine traditions and folkways grows up to give each new generation a sense of comfortable placement and interest and significance. Such a thing was well started in America by the first colonists, so that by 1700 there was a clearly defined local fabric and feeling based on the Northern European temperament and heritage in conjunction with the given climate and topography. The thing had sharply crystallized so that it could no longer be said that the land was an open country ready to receive all comers as material for a future civilization. And he goes through, it's much longer, I won't read the whole thing, but he goes through and describes how this, it's bullshit, basically, this idea that we're nothing but, you know, a country of immigrants, how there had been this American type that formed. And, you know, you see it when you study, look at the pictures of the generals of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. If you ever look at the picture, I mean, it was like a real type, an American type. Now, probably none of the three of us would have perfectly fit in with that type. But it's just, you know, you could absorb more, though, you know, once you get outside of the Anglo, you know, Celtic world, you can absorb. But the more different it gets, the harder it is to absorb it and weld it together. And the process that he's talking, see, that's the thing. It's the process he's talking about there of a people fitted to a land over time.
Yeah.
And how they develop, you know, this connection with the land. And that's the essence of a real civilization. And that's the thing,
right,
they're
that's
trying
what they
to
call
constantly disrupt.
Ethnogenesis. That's
right.
What the
exactly.
Call,
you know? Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, like the H.P. Lovecraft is a science fiction writer. Yeah. And he saw this so clearly back then in the 1930s. And it's like, imagine if somebody wrote something like that today.
Well, they would be I mean, they call him a Nazi. And there was an award for sci-fi fantasy fiction given out as H.P. Lovecraft, because people really liked his stuff until they started looking into this. And there are some of these SJW writers that have won this award in recent years that have like filmed themselves like smashing the award statue because it was H.P. Lovecraft and stuff. And yeah, interestingly, H.P. Lovecraft actually married a Jewess. He married
right.
She was a hat merchant. I think
that's how he became red pilled to the Jewish question.
It's entirely possible. But look, that's neither here nor there. It doesn't make what he said untrue. The thing I would also say about America, though, is that, remember, there was a whites-only immigration law for years, and then the National Origins Act in 1924, which was to respond to this mass immigration, and so they gave a couple of generations before 1965 for these different white European groups to sort of marinate together. And while there's certainly, like, if you go to Queens and Long Island, you get a different effect. You know, you get a different feel than if you're out in the Great Plains and stuff like that. Like, you get a very Germanic feel out there, and you get, like, a Southern European feel towards the East Coast or whatever. But these people are not so far into each other. You know, and people did acclimate over a couple generations to become another type. And we all would fit into that type. That's where we all come in, because we're all different, I would say. But there's not a conflict between us the way there is. The thing is, blacks persistently stayed separate from that. Persistently. And it's because of the racial difference there, the fundamental racial difference. And the same
it's like anything. Yeah. I mean, it's like if you're making a cake and you throw in, you know, you put honey in, or maple syrup, or chocolate, or peanut butter, or all these different things. They're complementary. You know, you throw hot sauce and mustard and, like, you know, stuff that's completely different, and it's going to taste like shit. It's disgusting. And again, this goes back to what we're talking about. Not let anything form up. Not let anything hold together.
I would argue, though, that that there are problems in the American ideology, in the liberal ideology itself.
No, there's
that
question.
Makes ethnogenesis very difficult.
There's
take for example suburbanization, right? That took people out of cities where they were rooted in these ethnic enclaves. You know, America was always. I would have to disagree slightly with you guys in the sense. The kind of composition you're talking about, because the idea of America was always you go in your community and you do your own thing, and we just live separately and do our own things and just get along once a year to do the national budget or some shit. That was the actual founding idea of America. That's why you have places like Maryland, which are for Catholics. You have the Mormon part. You have so on, so on. But as time went on, it was actually the Jewish element that capitalized on American liberalism, the idea that everyone is supposed to mind their own business. So if everyone's minding their own business, no one's actually in charge. So they made a beeline for the newspapers, for the banks, for the government positions, and so on, and became the undisputed masters of America by the 20th century.
When you're mentioning suburbs, Stryker, I mean, yeah. I've thought a lot about that too, because I lived on Long Island for a little while, and I'm from a rural area, so I was very surprised at how Long Island is just one gigantic suburb. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because when I was out there, I would meet people from like Brooklyn who grew up in the neighborhoods, and they reminded me more of rural people. The kind of people that I grew up around, they were friendlier and more hospitable than some of the lifelong suburbanites. Mm-hmm. And this phenomenon of shopping malls, because it's funny, too, you know, how the shopping mall was really I came across that a while back, how that was really like a Jewish I mean, it was all Jews that owned the big shopping malls, the first shopping malls.
God.
And how, of course, the first suburbs, like Levittown, you know, there's Levittown on Long Island, one
Levittown
in Eastern PA. There's like four Levittowns. So the first suburb. Well, I saw a documentary.
Suburbs were a this Jewish was, project.
They were. Well, I
Levittown.
Saw a documentary. Yeah. I saw a documentary that's on YouTube. It's still on YouTube. It's really good. I recommend it very strongly. It's kind of obscure. It's called Taken for a Ride, the U.S. History of the Assault on Public Transport in the Last Century. And it was made, I think, in like the early 90s. And what it's about is about how the system of streetcars, how this country once had this incredibly rich system of streetcars, and how they were deconstructed by the automobile industry that then built these massive highways all through the heart of cities. And this is true of so many cities in America, where it just broke up the downtown areas. They broke up the areas where people could live. This, in tandem with forced integration, forced housing and forced busing. Basically took, I mean, when you think about it, you think about Hitler's day in Munich. You could go around back then in Germany in a city, and it didn't have to be Hitler in Munich. It could be any white city. You could go around in a city because a city is a center of power. There's a lot of people. You can exercise influence, and you could go around and get a whole city on your side or get a movement going in a city. So it's like this had to be fragmented. And what you're talking about, the ethnic neighborhoods, they had to be broken up. The ethnic neighborhood, you would have a local church. Everybody walks to go to church on Sunday. Everybody has the local store, the little market, the bakery, the candy shop. The kids play together. And there's all this social cohesiveness when you are of age. You know, you meet a girl from your neighborhood because you're all around each other. And out of this forms, you know, everything, communities, everything comes out of this. So you have to break this down. Well, the corporations, particularly the automobile industry, really fought. This documentary reveals it, directly conspired to break down the streetcar systems that had developed and build these massive highways so everybody's just sitting in traffic. And then you take the forced housing and the forced busing, so people, you're literally breaking apart these neighborhoods. What does this do? It drives people out to these suburbs where the Jews are ready to build the suburbs, you know, get a big mortgage on this suburban house with a postage stamp fucking, you know, golf course lawn where you don't even know your own fucking neighbors. And then you have to, you know, your social life consists of going to a Jewish mall. And, you know, I had an interesting experience on that, and I'm hitting a lot of different things here, but it all ties together. I had an interesting experience with the malls back. I used to do some third party campaign work, and I would try to do ballot access petitioning, and I came across deplatforming very early on. This is like, like the little 2000s.
This is a thing that happened in New Jersey in 2000s.
Yeah, you go to the only place where there is foot traffic is the shopping mall.
They depoliticized them.
Well, yeah, they did, but it used to be the shopping mall is totally privately owned, and you can't talk to people there. Well, this is the same thing with Facebook and Twitter. It's the public spooks. You have privatized the public square. And that's the other thing. You know,
That they did this in – I know exactly what you're talking about now. There was a case that was in – because New Jersey is much like Long Island, that it's a total suburb. The whole state is a suburb.
Right, right.
And New Jersey and the mall and the broads with the big hair and all that stuff. And there's a lot going on there with – now, the automotive industry and the Defense Department have always been hand in hand. You know, and so they built, you know, the Defense Department also wanted the highways for civil defense, supposedly. And they
were
big funders. And then I'm not saying, but, you know, Eisenhower built this whole highway interstate system and blah, blah, blah. And yes, by the 80s, it had developed into a suburban system with the malls. And now sometimes SJWs even go after the early Levitt towns and suburbs because they were racially segregated. But I'm like, you had to do that to get whites out to them.
Right.
You had to tell whites, whites only. Levitt town is whites only. You had to say that in 1950 to get whites
to
move
there. The red pill on the people think, there's always the thing that people, they hear something and they think, oh, well, that's the truth. And then you hear what the real truth is.
Yeah.
People, it's common knowledge, like smarter people know, oh, well, the real reason they built the interstate system and the way they built it was for the Defense Department and for troop transport because they were worried about the Russians landing. That's kind of true, but the red pill beyond the red pill is that it was GM and the automobile industry lobbying the Defense Department.
But
that was the excuse they were giving to the Defense Department.
Right,
because once again, they wanted to make money off the and turn America. And that's the thing.
And the automotive industry and the has always been an integral part of the military-industrial complex in America.
It
that
has.
Was the point
hand
I was making.
Glove.
That these
hand
two,
in, yeah,
these
you're
two
right.
things are – and they make the tanks and the whole bit, right? And so, yeah, and then they also – They got the federal government to subsidize their product, which is cars. Hey, if we build these highways and we tell Americans they're free or they're being paid for by a tax, we are subsidizing cars.
Right.
So now people will buy cars because they have all these places to go in their cars. And, you know, I like on some level, I admire the feat of public engineering that this highway system represents.
But cutting through these old cities. I mean, not these old cities. You know, if you go to South America, you go to Europe, you go so many different places in the world, you'll find huge plazas, public squares with giant fountains and statues of like heroes. I mean, if you see this, you see it in so many cities around the world. you generally don't see it in American cities. I mean,
it's
you don't
rare.
See,
there's
like,
a few. It's rare, but there's a few where
public,
you see it, but
the public
it's rare.
Square, the public square is where politics are discussed, where people are organized, where people socialize,
right.
where you get to know your neighbor. The shopping mall, on the other hand, you're focused on shopping, not to mention the blaring rap music or pop music yeah. over the speakers. I mean, I was talking to my friends about this the other day. Like, you know, we were at the pub trying to have a little discussion about things, but it's just impossible to talk
yeah,
because
you can't
the music
do it.
Is so loud. And the reason the music is loud is because pubs are where the NSDAP was founded, the IRA started. You know, that's
well, this is
pub
think,
is where it's the public house. That's
and,
where people organize political resistance. And if music is blaring and everyone's doing the gyrating dances, no politics are being done. And that's why the system designs things like that.
Yeah, and that's why they excluded yeah. politics from the mall, and they did this specifically because I remember there were people leafleting at, and it was they were leftists at a mall in New Jersey, and this was a case in the early 2000s, and they pled free speech, and the government said no because this is all private property, so you can't leaflet on private property. So they took, and now if you remember, if you think about something like the Agora in Athens or the Forum in Rome, shopping and politics were done in the same place.
Right.
So people
right.
would go to the shops, they would go to the stands and the stores, and they would buy their items for the day, but they'd also then meet their friends, and they'd stand in public and they'd talk. And if you have like a downtown area that's open air where the sidewalks are public, people will do that. And I grew up in a town that did have a nice little three-block shopping area where the shops, the grocery store, and the shops were. And people would just, on Saturday, you just walk through town. Like on my Saturday afternoon, I get up and I just walk through town. And eventually, three-block walk, I'd find my friends somewhere in that, somewhere. I know they would be there, right? And so that's how it would work.
And that's
the
how
mall,
people met each other. That's what I'm saying. Young people,
that.
like
in a sense, the internet kind of adds a layer to that.
Yeah, the internet then further removed it. But then the internet also, because people could talk politics on the internet.
Briefly. Yeah, exactly. And that's
right, but think of it this way, though, that people could talk politics on the internet, but it's also all being documented. I mean,
yeah.
The kinds of conversations that get people fired from their jobs on the internet are the types of conversations they've always had in their living rooms or with their friends.
Yeah,
but
right.
now, because there's a record of it, even in private, now they're starting to hack people's Discords and their text messages and so on, and they release them to malicious bodies that spend all their time surveilling political dissidents.
This is an entirely new thing. I mean, this is actually remarkable.
So,
if you think about the Discord leaking of people that said things that were, all right, maybe they weren't the wisest thing to say, but so what? I mean, people say all kinds of stupid shit. And so only now is this, only now is this stuff brought up where it's like it's a permanent record. I mean, now if they don't want something to have a permanent record, like there's certain videos of things that happened that are very bad for their narrative that you can't find these videos anymore. They find a way to remove those. But
you guys noticed YouTube like shutting down videos in the last, I mean, in the last 2 months, it's shocking how many videos that like, I go to search for them. There was one video. It was George Lincoln Rockwell's birthday, and I was trying to get that video. It's one of him talking, just where he's talking to, you know, making a direct pitch to the American people. And I searched George Lincoln. And this video is uploaded like 10 years ago. So it's got millions and millions and millions of views, comments, everything.
Yeah,
and this is like 2 months ago, and it was still there. I had to search through like dozens of pages before I finally found it, and then it had been put in restricted mode. So, you know, 10 years worth of likes and comments and everything,
yeah, all
gone.
Of it removed. You can't
all of it
see
removed.
It. Yeah.
It is creepy shit, man. You
well,
can't share a Daily
mode.
Stormer argument. I had this happen too. A conservative friend of mine, I tried to share a Daily Stormer article on Messenger, and Facebook Messenger. It's a private message from one person to another, and it flagged it and said, "This is a we won't let you send this."
They do that to our site now too. They do that to TRS now too.
I can't believe that. I mean, it's so obvious though.
Dude,
they're bungling idiots. I mean,
they took TRS off of Google.
Yeah, like, well, okay, so a while ago, it's been almost, probably been more than a year, you cannot find links to our site searching on Google. On top of that, when about 3 weeks ago, I would say, when they made, Facebook made an announcement, when they made their announcement, they're removing white nationalist content. Then literally that same week, like within a day or two of that announcement, you could post links to TRS, but it wouldn't create the embedded link, so you don't see the thumbnail and the preview right. text and stuff, where it's just text. So you could post the link, but it's just text.
Just like a line of gibberish.
Yeah, it's just the link, the actual URL code itself, and so there's no more embedding, there's no more any of that. So you know, I know how to, you know, attach an image to the post or whatever to make it look attractive so people will click on it. But yeah, they removed the embedding of, and that's the most they can do. They cannot stop you from literally posting the text to the link, although they could eventually start banning people from doing that, which is what they might be talking about with InfoWars and such. So there's that with the internet censorship. But I think, you know, going from the we're kind of been all over the map here. Let's rein it back in. So going from the, we meant to talk about the Middle East. We kept going back to what we kind of really wanted to talk about, which is this economic and social stuff. Had a very good conversation on that. I thought it was a great conversation. Now we're kind of moving into talking about from talking about community, from racialism to communities to the public square, and now talking about the internet and censorship. I feel like we've talked about that a lot. Like, people kind of know with the internet censorship. If there's anything, any points anyone wants to add to that, because I don't want to just bitch about censorship.
No, me. No.
I want, one thing I want to say is, do you think the last batch of crackdowns is going to actually spur some kind of action from
the government?
Right?
No.
No.
No. No. They right. are the ones that did it.
Yeah.
My opinion. Now, this
that's
is
my I, view. That's my view. As well,
I said this on Twitter. I've said this on Tedious. These latest crackdowns on Laura Loomer and Milo and these other figures, say what you will about them, which, whatever, it doesn't really matter. The issue is these people were a thorn in the side of Conservatism Inc. And then when you add Louis Farrakhan, he's kind of like the cherry on top of the cupcake, right? He's kind of like, it's
stupid,
like,
conservatives that were like, well, why didn't you ban Louis Farrakhan?
Well, that was
Louis Farrakhan.
I mean,
well, we did it. And you got what you
that
wanted.
Was Laura
we
Loomer. That was Laura Loomer's
dumb
whole
shit.
Complaint. Remember, Laura Loomer was bitching when she was banned from Twitter that Louis Farrakhan was still on it. So in a poetic move, when they banned her completely from Facebook, they also banned him.
Right.
And there's no question in my mind, because Facebook is being very tight-lipped about this, and leftists were surprised by this as well. This was done from pressure from, as shall we say, the Jay Wright. This was Jay Wright.
I
if you look at like guys like Rick Wilson, they were cheering very openly, but I'm not sure if that is necessarily
That guy's just a douchebag. That guy is done because everybody hates him. Okay, he's just such an obvious douchebag. He's not going to have a seat at the table in whatever thing that they're creating, because Trump is going to be intimately involved with whatever they're creating, or the Trump brand, or pro-Trump politics, or seemingly pro-Trump politics. That guy already staked out fiercely anti-Trump position. Nobody wants to see that guy. But Ben Shapiro, even though he staked out a fiercely anti-Trump position,
Ben Shapiro, and also CRTV.
Okay.
That's another one. I see CRTV promoted heavily, and yet it doesn't seem to be catching.
Charlie Kirk, Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson, PragerU, these are the places where they want white, young, disaffected young white men to go. And they want to cut off your options to anything else. Now, Milo, there's a lot of things Milo says we don't like. There's a lot of things he does that we don't like. But he was legitimately like a direct on ramp to the alt-right. Like, that is true. Like, there's so many people that went from him right into our politics because he was edgy enough, but he left you like hungry, because it's like he says all this edgy stuff, but then he goes right back to shitty conservative Zionism that nobody really wants. So, you know, then you're like, oh, well, here's the off ramp for Milo right into the alt-right. So he was just too much of a conduit. And
do you guys feel, though, that big tech, I mean, I feel like the normal people Trump voters are, I mean, the fact that Tucker's talked about it as much as he has, the fact that Ann Coulter talked, you know, but then the fact that Trump has at least tweeted about it, and I know Trump is totally worthless on this issue, but the fact that he's tweeted about it, I feel like big tech, I remember like a year ago, less than a year ago, when big tech wasn't a term that people were really using. It was still, oh, isn't it wonderful, Google? You know, you guys see that meme where it's like, it showed people in the 60s and they're like, oh, I wonder if the government's, you know, watching me through my television and trying to listen, spy on what I'm saying. And then it showed today and it's like, you know, spying software. Can you give me a recipe on how to make this kind of barbecue? You know, you're talking into it, telling it, you know,
yeah,
what you were looking for. But I feel like this, you know, this whole idea of big tech being behind the scenes and just tweaking algorithms and making people do what they want, it's kind of a Jewish wet dream. You know, a handful of like kikes in Israel sitting behind computers and they're like, ah, you know, we just, all we did was alter this line of code and now all the goyim are voting this way. I think it's a great idea, but I think in practice, the old methods of just outright totalitarianism, like what the Soviets did with the NKVD and all that, I think that was a more effective way of controlling people. Because if you're afraid that you're just going to get dragged out and shot, you're going to be really afraid. But all this is doing is pissing people off. I mean, think that when I try to send a Daily Stormer, I told my conservative friend about that, and this is someone who, they do not read the Daily Stormer. They're shocked whenever I send them a Daily Stormer article. But that's why I send it, to just say, hey, look at this. This is an interesting perspective. You know, like, you should not be afraid to read this.
Yeah.
But I told them, I sent them a screenshot of the message I got, and man, were they pissed off, because it's like, wow, Facebook is trying to stop me from reading something. So, like I say, I feel like when I look at Mark Zuckerberg and these Jews, I mean, I really don't think they actually – I think they are in – somebody said this recently. We're in uncharted territory. I think they don't know what the hell they're doing here, and they're just making this up as they go along. They don't have a very comprehensive plan on how to – I think China – that the censorship in China is much more effective than this soft, weak shit that they're doing. All they're doing is pissing people off.
I disagree. I think that they're actually doing some pretty evil shit that's going to have some reverberating effects down the line. For example, take Amazon Echo or Google Home. You're literally putting devices with microphones in them in your house.
Everybody knows it, though, don't they? I mean, doesn't everybody, like, I feel like it's – people are talking about this. I mean, maybe
that's,
it's
the Soviet wet dream, though. Imagine if the population of the Soviet Union
voluntarily put the microphone in their home. What's so funny is that I remember years ago, even post Soviet Union, they were talking about how North Koreans all have a speaker in their house that's also a microphone. Now, I don't know if this is true, if this is U.S. propaganda. They're saying there's a speaker and microphone in every apartment and home in North Korea where the regime can address the people and can also listen, and it's required. And now it's like, well, here they made it into a consumer commodity, and people are putting it in their homes themselves. Now, I don't know what the market saturation of these products are. I know for damn sure that no one I know would ever have that in their home. But then you could also argue, well, your cell phone doubles as that. I don't think so. But it's, you know, the question is this, like, what are they ultimately going to do? What are they ultimately going to do?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I saw an article. It was Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, and she was talking about this censorship stuff. And I looked up Michelle Goldberg, and oh my God, is she a slimy caricature of a yeah. I had her Wikipedia page up. Born 1975, so she's like Gen X. Born in Buffalo. Master of Science degree in journalism from the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism, then worked for Salon for many years, then The Nation. And, you know, this is a person who is so and then it says on her Wikipedia page, personal life, she lives in Brooklyn with her husband, Matthew Ipkar. She is a self-described secular Jew. You know, it's like, these are the only voices that are going to be left. These like caricatures of Jewish feminists from Berkeley. I mean, people, it's, you know, this happened.
Vince Pial.
Well, I was going to say this.
That's
Mike,
dialectic.
You remember like the late 90s. I feel like the late 90s were, I mean, I was pretty young, but I was still aware of what was going on. And I feel like that was the period when – I remember when Gore and Bush debated, okay? I felt like the system was in much better control at that point.
Oh,
cable
totally.
Cable TV was huge. Magazines were still huge. The internet was there, but it wasn't like this big, big thing. It was still, you know. And they pretty much, like the Bush-Gore debate, there was just nobody was paying attention.
Nobody cared.
So you could go to people and you could tell them, hey, the white race is dying, white genocide or whatever. The earth is dying, anything. You know, hey, this is – you got to find out. People were just, hey, everybody's making money. Everybody feels good. Nobody watches politics. Nobody pays attention to politics. That was when they were at their best. This system is at its best when people are apolitical or depoliticized. Yeah. Stryker, you talked about that a lot.
Yeah. With
depoliticized through
that's what Mussolini and Hitler both criticized about America is
right.
The sheer lack of politicization of the public, and also how people tend to they tend to have identities based around consumer habits rather than political affiliations or anything of substance. They tend
they call
to
that
identify
psychographic with. Groups. Psychographic groups is like I listen to country music and I eat, you know, this or and I drive a pickup truck.
And
I,
that was totally all-consuming in America in the 90s. And
it
even
was.
The early 2000s to some extent. 9/11 and then the Iraq War following on its heels politicized a lot of people. And now the environment is hyper-politicized all the time. And for people that say that we're not having an impact... Well, we were just talking, we made the front page of the New York Times Sunday edition.
Oh yeah,
where they're talking about how there's a diet. We now the medieval scholars who of course as always in academia, this field of medieval studies is taken over by Jews, and they're now in they're jousting with the alt right, and then they talk.
Right.
Did you see this? And then they're talking about how they have to reexamine how they even talk and think about. Medieval studies to not make it so white centric, and this is a total reaction.
In other words, how do we teach about white history without mentioning white?
Yeah,
people?
How do we erase whiteness from the history of Europe? Well, you can't.
BBC literally doing this. I mean, you guys have seen. I don't know if you've talked about it on this show or if you've ever seen it, but how the BBC will do like period historical dramas and like.
Oh yeah,
cast non-whites in the roles just to be,
and they
like,
don't even say they don't even they make no mention of it. But the other thing is this: So then, why are they in a position where they're hyper politicizing things like that? Because that makes people then sit up and take notice. You're like, wait, what?
People get politicized. We win when people get politicized, and that's what I'm saying is that people, the fact that they're doing this shit. You know, you have a Michelle Goldberg that's the only opinion that's allowed to still – and she's just in the writing from the New York Times talking about, oh, this censorship is great. Isn't this good? You know, well, these people don't deserve to have a voice. You're going to have a system like the system that was in East Germany. If you guys have ever seen a German film called The Lives of Others, I recommend it very strongly.
Yes.
It's about – it's a really great film about the censorship in the police state of Germany, East Germany, and towards the end of the – and it's funny how everybody's going – and Tom Sunic and a number of other people who are from the Eastern Bloc countries have talked about this behind the Iron Curtain, but how like everybody was just walking around and knew that the party line is bullshit. Like everybody knows it.
Well, the interesting thing about Lives of Others is how everybody was phoning it in.
Even
the Stasi agent was like not that invested. He was just
he's kind of an absurd character because he's still studiously trying to do his job when the people above him don't even believe in it. And that's, you know, it's funny because the same thing's happening with stuff with the neoliberal elites in this country. They have dropped all pretenses of caring about anything but money and power. I mean, everything is just a cynical thing for them.
They've become quite infantilized as well. And one thing that they're suffering from is authentic counterculture's dead. So at least from the tradition, for example, take in the 1990s, things like grunge music, right?
Right.
That was a genuine grassroots countercultural movement. The problem is that with this new tech economy, all of these like little things that were really popular in the 90s and kind of underground culture, it's all been co-opted and turned into a consumer product, whether it's black metal, grunge music, Things like this are now like put in little cups for sampling, like it's a wine tasting party. No one actually pours their heart and soul into these things anymore, which leaves a huge vacuum where people do want an actual identity that isn't, fickle or something that single serving, like single serving friends in Fight Club.
It's just not plastic. You know, it's not plastic. Mike, you travel all over the country. You see, do you notice how I just did some cross-country traveling, and it's creepy to me the way in more and more, it's just the same fucking franchises everywhere you go. Like, you know, every town in America, it's just the same corporate franchises. And that.
Bro, the world is starting to look that way.
Oh, I know.
Capital city in the world has the same franchise.
And that creates a yearning for authenticity. But yeah, when you have this system where this bullshit is so transparent and it's so fake and people are living in fear and people are hyper politicized. That's why I say, I think that all this censorship that they're doing right now, Goebbels, there's a line by Goebbels, that speech where he says, you know, everything that they've done up to now has really been sort of like a piece of bungling because they weren't able, they had control of the radio, the press, everything, and still we won, you know? So, and then he says, you know, that we're not going to, you know, basically we won't make the same mistake, you know, that they made. I remember there was something, a line from his diary when he finally got in the chancellery and these guys came to them from the old order. I think they were like conservatives, and they were basically like, all right, well, now that you've won, we'll lend you our support on this issue or that issue if in return you'll do this and that for us. And he was just laughing like, you don't realize what just happened, you know? Yeah. You're not going to get us out of this building alive. I mean, like, we've won now, you know? And they sense that. They know that if we win, if we even start to win, the gig is up for them for good. You know, if the shoe is on the other foot, they're not going to get a second chance, you know,
the naked careerism of the new elites, and also the nepotism that, you know, the people in charge now are the children of people who probably had some merit. For example, take a Bill versus Irving Kristol, right?
Yes. You talked Irving about Kristol. Yeah, absolutely.
And who even knows what – does William Kristol have children? Who even knows what kind of wastes of flesh they are?
Right.
Yeah. They're probably hipsters living in Brooklyn, probably in some anarchist
country. Even Jared Kushner. Yeah. I mean, Jared Kushner is really – it's the big funny final red pill on Jared Kushner. He's just kind of an idiot. I mean, he's not like this scheming, like, you know, no wonder he never says anything. I mean, he's
not
just
very smart, and it comes out when you read this book about the Kushners where, like, he was a C student, and he got into Harvard because his dad bought – now his father
– George W. Bush.
Even Charles –
that's another
Kushner,
great example.
Even Charles Kushner. Charles Kushner is he's like other Jews, like Schumer, like, hates Kushner because he's like, all you just literally try to buy your way into everything. Right, you don't scheme at all. Like, you
there's survival of the fittest. I mean, you know, when you remove struggle, you know, you see this, Tucker Carlson writes about Chelsea Clinton, but you see it with Hillary Clinton. The fact that she was shielded from having to actually fight for the nomination, whereas Trump had to fight tooth and nail against the media and everybody else and all the other candidates. It actually didn't do her any favors. And that's what's funny about this elite ruling class right now. They're not really that elite. I mean, that's the big joke. You know, Jack London writes about this in The Iron Heel. He said that the ruling, the oligarchs, they're intelligent when it comes to money and business, but that's about it. They're like morons when it comes to everything else. They have no understanding of history or psychology or whatever.
Well, you know what it is too, is the actual, the focus of power, the center of power in the modern world is the tech economy. What kind of minds are attracted to computers and numbers and things like that? Well, those are very binary minds with poor sense of social intuition. So it's actually very difficult for them to try and control the public in a way that is psychologically not going to cause a reaction, because, frankly, they're a bunch of spurbs. So you compare that to the old style of Jewish control, and you have what? You have newspaper men. You have academics, you know, activists, Abby Hoffman types. Those guys had their ear to the ground when it came to youth counterculture, when it came to how people, for example, take what was Sigmund Freud's nephew, the guy who invented P- PR.
Edward Bernays.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take that guy. That guy was a genius.
Yeah.
You know, that guy had a great intuition for the public, what the average goyim actually sees as freedom, how he relates it to a product, and so on. He knew how to manipulate people. Someone like Zuckerberg, that guy can barely
function in a social situation. Yeah. He really can't. And yeah, no, I've this is definitely part of it. And it's sort of funny, when I worked in tech, I always, not to toot my own horn or anything, but I found myself to be oftentimes the only guy in the room with any kind of social intelligence outside of the creatives. Like, if dealing with the creative people, they were social, but the tech people, the other programmers, like, I would always have to be the liaison because these people could not. And Zuckerberg is one of them. And on some level, Zuckerberg is still, like, he's part of the elite, but he takes orders. Like, he's not an idea guy. He takes orders. But then you see
he's very young, too.
Ham-fisted things that they do. And they can only be kind of ham-fisted in this. Now, when you think about it, the internet as a medium is interesting, because if you look at when new media comes out, like, there's a bunch of things that come up, and then there's a consolidation. And in radio, remember, Father Coughlin at one point had like 20 million some odd listeners in the United States when radio was still relatively new. And then it became consolidated under the major companies. Now, with TV, when that technology came out, that was kind of just a variation of radio. It was just like a more expensive radio. So they already had control. And you can actually find how the Jews literally sat in a room and plotted to control the TV industry when TV became a thing. They literally plotted how to, like, it's actually like in a room a group of Jews sat down and planned how to control it. It's pretty funny. But
well, that's what happened to Coughlin too. That was CBS. Oh, yeah, RCA.
They ultimately removed them.
All of them owned by the tribe, and they simply came together. Just like, I mean, listen to the Fascism Now episode I did about a year ago.
Yeah,
it was a great one.
Father Coughlin.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah,
I visited the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, Michigan. If you get a chance, go and look at it. He had this like wizard's tower that he broadcasted from. It was amazing. It's part of the church. It was this huge Art Deco. Like, I mean, it looks very fashy, very fashy. My grandmother was a big listener of his, but yeah, he had like, his audience blew away like Rush Limbaugh's by many, many times. It was
because there was
he was one of the first political broadcasters on radio.
He was. Yeah. And he was his magazine, you talked about the Striker, but his magazine was called Social Justice.
Yes.
I mean, he was, and you know what? There's a thing, if you go to his church there, and like I said, it's beautiful. And they don't really emphasize Coughlin too much because you can tell they don't want to attract the enemy. Actually, we shouldn't talk about it on the show. But there's a thing there, a huge mural, and it says, "No capital without labor, no labor without capital." So a very kind of third positionist, reconciling the owners and the workers, the laborers.
Oh, Coughlin, you know, just to put that in some context, Coughlin, along with Gerald K. Smith and Huey Long, they mounted a populist challenge to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936.
Yes. Yeah.
And that ended with Mr. Long being assassinated
by a Jew.
Actually, to be fair, it's not proven that guy is or was Jewish. But
maybe the sources I'm reading.
What isn't deniable is that this guy was connected to the Roosevelt people.
There's
on
a
some
book,
level because they were going to steal the Democratic nomination from FDR. Okay,
right.
And this is entirely it's actually quite remarkable how history repeats itself, because it was just like with Trump. But the thing is that they were able to nip that in the bud, but it was entirely
Bernie Sanders,
technological mediums where, you know, people like Gerald Smith, this firebrand Protestant preacher, he put aside his sectarian differences with Father Coughlin, who was a Catholic priest with this huge radio audience, and they put together all of their influence and followers to create this huge populist insurrection during the Great Depression. Because remember, I think Ahab over here was telling me this the other day. The U.S. economy was starting to slow down by the end of the 1930s.
It
the
was.
New Deal, New Deal was a huge bust.
Pseudo-socialism. Pseudo-socialism is what Hitler called it. He made fun of it because it's like you want to keep the capitalists running everything. And this is exactly what Trump's doing with Mnuchin and that fucking Goldman Sachs Jew that he had in there. It's like you don't want to harm the capital. And this is the same thing Obama did.
Gary Cohn.
Gary Cohn, exactly. I mean, it's another John Bolton. Like, you know, you're railing against Wall Street. You put the physical embodiment of Wall Street, the manifestation of it. You put him in charge. But Father Coughlin, the interesting thing about the reforms that were passed by the New Deal, like Social Security, that was policy of a guy named Townsend. I think Francis Townsend, and he was an ally of Huey Long and Father Coughlin. And it was pressure from, you know, you could say the left, but these guys were populists and nationalists, and Father Coughlin was certainly a staunch anti-communist. But it was pressure from these guys that made Roosevelt do the things that he did do. He was reacting to pressure from the populist, you could say the populist right.
And they've erased that history.
Oh, totally.
They've totally erased that history.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you guys could spurge out on that stuff. Thing, I was another, making no, a hold different on.
Another,
point,
one
though.
One last thing, okay. though. Another thing that another thing that they've erased is the fact that Huey Long and Father Coughlin and Gerald Smith were campaigning against a European war in 1936.
Yes.
They knew that Roosevelt was in their pocket. Right. And they were saying this outright, and Roosevelt was forced to run as an anti-war candidate solely because of these guys.
Just like Woodrow Wilson did. They all had to run. They all run as anti-war. George W. fucking Bush ran as an anti-war candidate, you remember. They all run as an anti-war candidate, and then they all end up doing it. And if Trump is going to suddenly be – I mean – imagine that if it ends up that Trump is the guy that kicks off a new Middle East war. But the point I was making, before we get back to that, the point I was making was about media and how these media were brought under control. And right now they are trying to do the same process with the internet. The internet presents technical challenges in doing that these other media did not. In other words, it is more decentralized, and I'm not going to be big on the whole decentralization that ANCAP shit, but it does mean that it is harder for the big players to come and get a total handle on it. And this is something that's frustrating to them. Now they create the virtual control by they have the platforms that are the effective public square, and then all these little websites on the periphery are going to end up being like ham radio was, right? Ham radio was to CBS, you know, minor dissident websites will be to Facebook and Twitter and Google, etc. But we have the ability to make that not happen. It's incumbent upon us to make that not happen. And
that's why the IRL stuff, handing out leaflets and street demonstrations and all that, you know, I know we have to shore up things on the legal front and other ways. People have to get their lives in a position. I mean, everybody should be doing that. I think everybody that's a listener of this show should be trying to get their life in set up so that they are not vulnerable to doxing and, you know, economic boycott. But we have to be able to go out in the public square again because that gets attention. And if they shut you down everywhere but IRL, then you can still talk IRL until they shut that. You know, and people are like, oh, well, how long before they shut that? Well, they haven't yet.
Make them do it. Whenever somebody says, hey, you want to do this? You want to do a demonstration? They're going to shut you down. Make them do it. You want to create a website? They're going to shut you down. Make them do it. They're going to ban your account. Make them do it. You're gonna pursue a legal action. Well, they're not going to accept your argument. Well, make them do it. Make them fight for their position.
Make them violate their own rules.
And make them violate their own rules. Yeah. Make them openly. Yeah. Make them openly
and also
violate
draw
their,
them out. Draw them out into the fight, because that's when they start to make mistakes and they're visible.
And when they also,
you know, the enemy for everything they say about us, that we thrive in anonymity and the darkness and the shadows, that's actually them. Because if people actually saw what they were doing, like more people saw it for what it is, they would be in a load of shit right now.
Well, why else do they hide? I mean, this is the thing. Yeah. Like, why? Like, Trump doesn't hide the fact that he's president. So why, when you say AIPAC runs foreign policy, do they scurry like rats and try and deny it?
Right.
Why do they do that? Because they know that it's not popular. They know that people don't want it, and they have to hide. They have to hide their influence.
Furthermore, doing stuff in real life needs to be the next step. I mean, that's actually something Roosh is doing right now. Whatever people's criticisms of him aren't. I think he does some good work on his front, on the masculine traditional gender role stuff. But he's actually going on a 60-city tour over the next 6 months. And he said it best. He's like, I'm sick of interacting with people on the internet, especially now that, like, there's less and less ability to interact with people. I actually want to meet my followers and friends and people that read my books face to face.
I mean, we
honestly, that is always going to be your best bet. Yeah. Meeting people face to face and getting together with people at the pub, at some event, at some whatever, having a happy hour with them. Meeting at a house, whatever you have to do. This is how dissent is actually cultivated.
Right. We've done a number of events, and we're going to do more. We've done events all over the country. We've done TRS events, strike and mic events. We're going to do more in the future. Trust us, we will. And ultimately, this is these are the things I look forward to the most. And it doesn't always have to be a protest. I think that we will become in a situation where the legal attacks that people suffered that made people shy away from that type of activism, there's a few ways to counter it. And I don't want to make this like how to do activism hour, because I think it's better to do than just to talk about it.
Right.
One, because it's not very entertaining to listen to people talk about it. And then two, we don't want to necessarily talk about what we're going to do, because we have enemies that are always looking out to try and find out. But I'll just say this. The strategy that they have of getting the police to leave you unprotected and sucker punching you to draw you into fights and draw you into legal stuff like that or whatever, we have ways to deal with that. There's ways to counter that. And all we need is the willpower to go out and do things. And I think that is starting to build again. And when I say go out and do things, I'm talking about, obviously, legal First Amendment activities. Like, we're not
First Amendment.
There is no such thing as alt-righters planning riots. That never happened. It never will happen. And it never has happened. And to the extent the media tells you different, they're lying. Everyone listening to this show knows that. The RAM people were completely set up. But people were caught blindsided. They didn't realize how... This strategy of having the police stand down, because people always assume, well, the police don't want to see a brawl. Well, right. I guess that's not actually true. They don't really care. It's more important. The political goal is more important. So they're happy for there to be a brawl, and they're happy for people to get hit by cars and die and for all kinds of chaos to ensue, as long as the resulting political point can be made. So now we know that. Okay, so that's something that we know, so we can account for it. So...
on some level, people still had faith that the institutions would work. But the problem is that, you know, back in the 90s, even the early 2000s, there was a lot of corruption then. But it still always felt that when you get into court or when you deal with the police, that there's an adult in the room.
Yeah.
It no longer feels that way.
Right. And now that threw people
like
that. Yeah. Really shook people's confidence, because they're like, hey, what the hell? And that's understandable, but that just means that new and different strategies.
You'd
have
always
to be
assume
developed.
That there'd be an adult in the room, in the sense that they'd be like, "Listen, I, you know, what they're doing, I don't agree with it, but they do have a First Amendment right to do it, so you got to let."
There was an assumption that they would stop people brawling in the street.
Right.
Yeah.
There was a base level assumption that even if they don't give a fuck, even if they're happy to throw Nazis in jail, they don't want brawls in the middle of the street that are going to lead to injuries and property damage. You at least assume that. But that's not even true. So now we have to understand that. And well, we certainly know it's not true in a communist enclave like Charlottesville. So you go somewhere else. Look, there's things that can be done. And again, I don't want to make this like the let's go do protests hour, but we're going to be changing up and doing different things. And IRL meetups and things are definitely very important. So, yeah.
I don't know anybody, too, that we talked about this, I think, on People's Square Striker, but I don't know anybody that has been red-pilled to what's going on in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years who has – I mean, we've had a few recently, a few high-profile people that, oh, I was wrong, you know. But in their hearts, I don't know anybody who has been like, you know what, now I'm a convinced liberal. So the whole thing is underground right now, and what I've experienced personally is just – a lot of community building, one-on-one, a lot of good friendships formed and trust and things that aren't just politics, you know. That's all been happening right now because they've forced everybody under. And those ties that have been built are still going to be there when we resurface again to do legal, constitutional, you know, political activity. But those ties are going to be there. And persecution has a way of strengthening those ties between people. When you go to a different city and you meet a fellow political dissident who sees the same truth you do, there's an instant level of trust and friendship that you just can't get that anywhere else. You think they have that among their fucking creeps? I mean, among – do you think Michelle Goldberg and her fellow Berkeley graduate, you know, writers, ex-writers for Salon, you think they have that with each other? I mean, they don't – that's the thing. There is no Red Guard opposing us. There is no hardcore, like, revolutionary core of totalitarians. Well,
that's the contradiction. Like, this is why I don't believe in left and right, because this is – I was arguing this with someone before because they were arguing that I'm far right or something. And I'm like, well, I'm not really far right because of this and that and this and that. But the argument I would make is that every group that's on the outside is – in a sense, left wing, because they're revolutionary. But then when that group gets into power, they become right wing, thus reactionary. So you take, for example, the Berkeley free speech movement. Those guys were the ones that were demanding more rights for students to organize politically on campus. Now, of course, these were Maoists running an angle. So they get into power, and what do? They go from left wing revolutionaries trying to push for a result to right wing establishment cretins that are trying to avoid a result. They're doing everything in their power to avoid the other side from politically organizing. So left and right, it all depends on how much power you have. When people have power, they ultimately become reactionary because they want to keep their power. And that's what we see now.
Hitler joked about, he said, the ghastliest joke in world history, Jewish stockbrokers became Jewish labor leaders. And it's funny because that is exactly what happened in reverse with the neoconservatives. You know, it's like Jewish leftists became literally, like Irving Kristol, became, Marxist radicals when they were outside the system. Once they're inside, you know, they're suddenly this they're conservatives, but a new type of conservative.
The neo thing. I mean, the mainstream narrative on the development of the neoconservative movement is always a laugh riot. They're like, wow, these were communist radicals that became conservatives with a more socially liberal. And I'm like, they're Jews.
Lefties for Reagan. Yeah.
They're Jews. They're Jews. And they totally discounted the effect of Jewish nationalism, Zionism, all of the things that really influence these people. They discount. It's like you never hear about it. Like, oh, these were people that suddenly were communists. And then they became hardcore Zionists.
And it's funny, too.
How did that happen?
We laughed about how it's sort of like who's getting the last laugh here. And we may get the last laugh or they may. But on the neoconservative question, it's like, oh, the neoconservatives are utterly discredited, humiliated, driven from the Republican Party, driven from the primary.
They're not driven from the party.
And then Trump gets in, the guy who was the antithesis of neoconservatism in the whole primary, and he appoints John Bolton, and he's just sitting there grinning underneath his mustache.
Yeah,
you know, about like, hey, I guess the joke was on you. You thought we were out of power, but I guess we weren't. And you know, it's funny because Farrakhan just got banned off Facebook. I remember something that really stuck in my mind that Farrakhan said years ago when in 2008, or maybe it was 2007. It's when Obama was running, and 60 Minutes, I think, did an interview with Farrakhan where they asked him, you know, is Obama, you like him? And he's like, yeah, I like him. You know, I'm not saying for sure I'm going to vote for him, but I like him. And they said, well, do you think he's an answer to George W. Bush and what he represents? And Farrakhan said something like, he goes, no, he says, because the nature of this system, he says, corrupts people. And he says, and unless you uproot the structure that corrupts them, you still don't have a president. You have a figurehead. And it's funny because, man, was he right about that with Obama and then now with Trump. If you don't change, uproot the actual structure, and the alt-right's the only force in the country right now that's actually really talking about that.
I think the Farrakhan ban is actually something that is noteworthy because a lot of people are rallying around Farrakhan. Michael Flegger, Father Michael Flegger, he's a pastor at the St. Sabina Church. He's inviting Farrakhan to his church, and he's expressing solidarity. He's a white guy too, by the way. He says, "How dare Facebook ban Minister Farrakhan? I stand with my brother, Mr. Zuckerberg. Your hypocrisy and double standards are disgraceful. Lift the ban. Support Farrakhan."
Well, their view of Farrakhan is such a cartoonish caricature that it's one of those things that if you want to red normies on, or like when I say normies, like conservatives, on this whole thing with Alex Jones and Farrakhan, you can go on the NOI, Nation of Islam website, and find Alex Jones's interview that was on YouTube, his interview that he did with Farrakhan, and watch. There's a clip. It's like 2.5 minutes of their opening dialogue. And it's the two of them speaking so respect. And it's funny because by proxy, Alex Jones is basically representing white America. And he is. I mean, I used to have coworkers that listened to Alex Jones. I mean, he was broad based,
very popular.
And he is speaking so respectfully towards Farrakhan. And Farrakhan is, you know, because Farrakhan can be very, very eloquent when he wants to be, so respectful towards. And he says that, you know, I think I'm well known among my people, among black people, but I don't think white Americans have had a chance to hear, you know, my point of view, because it's been, and they just have such a beautiful dialogue. And it's like, so what this tells you everything, that these two are banned, that should tell you everything you need to know.
You know, it's kind of, listen, Farrakhan does say some anti-white shit, but you know what? We say some anti-black
shit. Yeah, I was going to say, we say stuff about
like, blacks. But it's actually, consider this though. The anti-white stuff he does say is kind of periphery. He actually focuses most of his ire towards the power structure and the Jews. And he actually says things he wouldn't. And I actually agree with the things he says. He's like, I don't want black people marrying white women.
Well, yeah, why is that?
We agree on that.
Criticisms of Farrakhan coming from the so-called right are always from a liberal perspective. And this is something,
just like the ones against Islam.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it is an attack on Islam. And this is where they want to put you. They want you to be in a place where you are coming at these figures that are. Now, Farrakhan is not for white people. He doesn't want to be for white people. And that's, I respect that. Why as white nationalists would we be against that? Why wouldn't we be for that? Why wouldn't we be like, here's a guy that's on the same wavelength as us as far as the Jewish question, and is on the same wavelength as us as far as racial nationalism, and he wants to take – I want blacks to be part of Farrakhan's congregation.
Yeah.
It's interesting what he says.
Why would I want any different?
You can learn a lot from Farrakhan just because he's been a very – I mean, the black people in this country
The other funny thing is when you see the right. Okay, sorry.
He said Farrakhan said this one time. He said Farrakhan is not anti-black. He says, or anti-white. He says Farrakhan is pro-black.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a very simple way of putting it. But that's something that anybody can understand. And
the average frizzy-haired mulatto in academia is far more virile.
Way more anti-white.
Louis Farrakhan.
The average blonde-haired, blue-eyed white person is in academia is more anti-white than Louis Farrakhan.
Louis Farrakhan, when he talks about white people, he it's never with like a personalized vitriol. He always does it in a kind of objective way, which is what we have to kind of work on, to talk about different groups and stuff by observing them from above, not taking it personally. I mean, listen, we all have bad experiences with multiculturalism, but you have to look at the systemic problem too, because that's how you solve it. If you just get caught up in your day-to-day experiences, you're going to, you know, basically waste your time chasing on a wild goose chase. If you actually look at the systemic problems, you might be able to solve it. Over here, Farrakhan is saying, well, we got this white boy running Facebook. Of course, you know, we can interject there. But anyway, because we got this white boy running Facebook, but we can't let white people define what we can or cannot think or read. So what we should do instead, he says, is create a black book. Right. He wants to create a Facebook, but for blacks.
Right,
Which would actually probably be like the funniest.
That's a great idea.
It
would be hilarious.
It would be really funny. But that's Farrakhan's original sin.
YouTube, it's World Star Hip Hop.
That's Farrakhan's original sin, though, to the system. It's not even that he's anti-Jewish. It's that he is building what we were talking about earlier, community, self-sufficiency, independence from the financial system, from the corporations.
He's talking about that. I mean, I don't know the extent to which whatever. I mean, look, I don't want to be licking this guy's balls all show, but like, I do like Farrakhan, and I do think that he's kind of the. There's a reason they banned him, and there's a reason why George Lincoln Rockwell worked with the Nation of Islam, and why I think that this is a place now. If you're really tired of blacks. You should be wanting them to be involved in something like Nation of Islam. Better that they're involved in that than Global Homo, the culture that Global Homo presents to blacks, which is we know what it is, like the exactly
mumble rap.
yeah, exactly. And then it also presents that culture to young white people, and then they absorb that. So that's why they and he also does call out Jewish power, and that's why they want him banned. And so, of course, you see in the discourse of the mainstream right that the criticisms and attacks on Farrakhan, and then they'll let you see supposedly anti-white statements are more just like personally insulting things he'll say about whites. But we don't really have any room to say, well, we don't ever say personally insulting things about blacks, because everybody does. You're not going to be – I'm a little bit like sanguine about that, because you're not going to get – white people and black people that aren't going to talk shit on each other. They just will.
Yeah.
It's just going to happen. It's just going to happen.
Why take it personal?
But yeah, it doesn't even make me mad. When I see blacks saying anti-white shit, I shrug it off. I'm like, what the hell do I care?
An existing grievance, when there's an existing grievance, and then there's going to be tensions, and as you resolve the grievances, and you do that through separation, but you also do that through negotiation and dialogue, and that's what Farrakhan was doing there with Alex Jones. And if we had our shit together, and we were a bigger force than we are, we would do it with him or with anybody else. But that's how you – once you resolve those underlying grievances, that's when the hostility will disappear. But – as long as this system, perpetuates everything, it mixes everybody together, it forces everybody down everybody else's throat, it brings out the worst in whites and blacks, within themselves.
One thing I'll say about the Farrakhan banning, though, I just saw this now. There's this black rapper. He's like a Bernie Sanders supporter. His name is Killer Mike. And he's actually standing up for free speech here. He says, no matter where you stand with the Caps or Roseanne's, the Alex Jones or Farrakhan, with the Kevin Harts or Ann Coulters, if you cheer for others you disagree with to be silenced, you will be muzzled when you deliver you as well, or something like that.
Right, and so, it's easy. It's so
this
much
is
easier.
Good because you know what? Actually, black celebrities and blacks with a platform, now that Farrakhan has been involved, are more likely to speak up, and that actually, what does that do? That isolates Jews.
Yeah.
Because now it becomes clear that this is – because the way Jews present censorship is that they're trying to protect the feelings of blacks and browns and so on.
Black people aren't. Their feelings aren't hurt. That's the thing, yeah.
When all the black people are coming out saying, wait a second, you're not doing this for me, what does that leave? Well – it just leaves.
Well, they're kicking black. I mean, they don't need black people anymore. I mean, this system really doesn't. It hasn't actually for decades. I mean, that's why they've just been sitting in ghettos, are really like they're fucking Indian reservations. I mean, it's an urban, an Indian reservation in the middle of white city. So it has the added bonus of disrupting whites, from their communal
blacks
life.
Are only used when they're used as a weapon against whites. They don't really care about them. And the perfect example is something we talked about on TDS yesterday. We talked about this lynching museum that they erected. They put a black guy named Brian Stevenson out in front of it. They created this museum to lynching. Now, there was 5,800 victims of lynching, but they're only memorializing 4,400. Why? Because 1,400 were white. But and look, they were probably not victims. They were probably criminals if you go back and you look. So 4,400 victims of lynching. They built millions of dollars, Jewish money is poured in Montgomery, Alabama, home of the SPLC, to an anti-white, white guilt memorial. Blacks don't go there. Whites don't go there. They send school children there to be indoctrinated into the white guilt cult.
Oh my God.
And so the thing is, nobody gives a shit about this, because if they really cared, they would look at the 2 to 3 times of number of that of the lynchings over a 100-year period that are killed every year by black-on-black crime in gang and drug and other related violence in the black ghettos. So you get some 10 to 12,000 to 14,000 murders a year of black-on-black. You get 100 sometimes in one weekend in Chicago. So if they really cared, they'd be looking at that. Now, some of that stuff is, we understand, racial issues or whatever. But the point is, that's when blacks get attention, when they do this stuff, when they build a museum to effectively white. It's a white guilt museum. You're supposed to feel guilty. And they want to take these pillars to the lynched and put them up in town, 800 counties and towns around America, so that on your Sunday outing, you see this and you're like, wow, white people sure are bad, aren't they? Look, but then they never tell you the context of why this black man or why this person was lynched. And, of course, they tell the lie. That blacks, this black man raised his head to a white man, and he was burned alive. That never happened.
It'll be a rapist monument, like what the, memorial. I mean, that's what they used to say about the Soviet monument in Berlin. You know, it's the rapist monument, the monument to this huge statue celebrating the rape of Berlin. Well, that's what this is. It's like, all the poor rapists that were hanged.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just like it's stupid. But that's the kind of stuff that's going to get Jewish money poured into it. Whereas Farrakhan, he's not interested in that. He wants to do something else. And now you can have your opinion about how well that's going to work or whatever. But the point is also, you can't take a you got to be careful. And the alt-right is so good about this. We're kind of preaching to the choir. We have been really good about this, to the point where we make fun of it on a regular basis, of conservatives that continue to take the Jewish bait and attack this stuff from a liberal perspective. They absorb the Jewish narrative, and then they go after guys like Farrakhan. And they go after, they'll go after Islam and other things for anti-liberal characteristics that we would actually like to emulate. Which is not to say we want to put burqas on, but there's element that they always go after the elements of Islam that are things that we have lost in the West, which is the gender roles, the anti-homosexuality. They go after Farrakhan for his racial nationalism. They go after him for his suspicion of the Jews. You know, they go after him for his attacks on global homo. So it's always the same things. And
Mike,
conservatives take that bait every fucking time. And their media will continue to give it to them. So Breitbart's not even going to complain about Milo being banned, who is their former employee. But Milo was a liberal faggot. Farrakhan is a far more significant banning. I mean, I remember alt-right Twitter the day Farrakhan was banned. Everyone was pressing F for Farrakhan, not for Milo and Laura Loomer, who are liberals.
Right.
So that's the way we got to go with it. I think that's more important. Some people, I know, Warren, you're a big admirer. That's great. Some people, you don't have to admire Farrakhan as much, but understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to necessarily put a black man on your top list of heroes, but understand what I'm talking about. Don't take the bait of going after these people from a liberal perspective, from a Jewish perspective, and understand how these people are also undermining Jewish power, and at the very least, they're allies in that.
Right. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, they are resisting the censorship more effectively than our team is. Okay.
Well,
I mean, there's way more
blacks get more leeway
standing up for. Wait, there's way more black people standing up for Farrakhan, and even more white people standing up for Farrakhan than there are for Alex Jones, even.
Well, it's the old Goebbels thing. The more a movement or a person is attacked by the Jew, the more valuable it is. You know, the more that it is praised by the Jew, he who is praised by the Jew is useless and dangerous. And it's like that. It's that simple. It's really that simple.
Yeah, it really is that simple.
Yeah,
it really is. And so, you know, we see
Goebbels said it best, too, that like it's a sign of good hygiene when they really hate you.
right. Yeah.
Being hated by the Jews is a sign of hygiene.
Which is also why, you know, you'll see these conservatives and they'll say, like, they go after and I even saw some of the more, shall we say, conservative adjacent people on like, I don't want to call anybody out or any particular element out, but there's some people I saw on Twitter that were saying things about progressives and Democrats refusing to go after Farrakhan for his thing. And of course, they put up Tamika Mallory. I'm like, Tamika Mallory is not a progressive. Tamika Mallory is black. Okay, right. Tamika Mallory is black. That is why she likes Farrakhan. That is why it's going to be difficult for the Jews to create a cleavage there, for them to drive a wedge there. And this
what
is
if
actually
they
why
unban him?
This
what
is
if,
actually
what if they unban
why
him as a concession.
This is actually why Tamika Mallory. Well, hold on a second. This is actually why Tamika Mallory was ultimately also removed. Like the whole Starbucks thing with Black Lives Matter and the agitation there. We went over this on Strike and Mike several weeks ago or months ago, where we talked about how Howard Schultz wanted to do this black day at Starbucks, really anti-white day, and Black Lives Matter was participating, but they pulled out because of the ADL, because the ADL works on training police. And so they're like, we don't want that. And then, you know, they refuse to disavow Farrakhan, all these things. So Black Lives Matter, the reason you don't hear much from them anymore in the Jewish Antifa Jewish press is because they became a thorn in the side. Because they became more black than they were anti-white. They became more black than they were global homo. They became more black than they were Jewish. And so that was a problem. So they're like, so you get these grug brain conservatives. They're like calling out Tamika Mallory for her refusal to condemn Farrakhan and her continual appearance and praise of him. And I'm like, well, that's because she's black, you fucking morons.
Well, it's funny, too, because what you're talking about Iran, one of the reasons I am an admirer of Farrakhan is how forcefully he came out against the Iraq war. He gave a press conference at the
That was when I first started noticing him in my youth.
Yeah. He was great, man, on that. And then also on Libya, on the invasion of Libya, because he was a friend of Muammar Gaddafi. And his forceful denunciation of those two wars. So, you know, any further move, I mean, why don't they just wait for him to die? I mean, he's very old, you know, like they could just wait. But instead, they're like stirring up this pot again, which, like I said, I think they're
Streisand affecting him.
Remember, the Jews are very neurotic people, and they sometimes do things that are pretty stupid because they get spooked, you know. They get a little scared and they think, oh, we gotta, you know, shut it down. I mean, the meme of shutting it down. And like this, why would they do that? I mean, dude, whatever Farrakhan's voice is magnified so much more now in the last like years of his
this
life.
Was why I was
well, he's
sure.
85.
This issue is why I was – this is what clinched it for me, that this was a conservative effort, that these bannings were conservatives having secret meetings with Facebook and giving Facebook – because this is the dumb shit that conservatives do. Like this is the dumb kind of shit that they would do, because they're like, here, we want these, and these. But then also because Laura Loomer has been bitching that Farrakhan is still on there, then he's got to go too. And also the only people I have ever heard bitch about Farrakhan are – conservatives or conservative presenting Jews, but it always comes from that angle. And it's a way of getting stupid conservatives back into a liberal worldview, which
well,
is
you know,
of course
I
what they
worried
have
about
anyway
them. I was worried about them trying to take Trumpism and just as soon as it's out of the picture, returning, going back to Mitt Romney Paul Ryanism. But it's clear what the plan is now. Just keep it MAGA. Keep it Trump.
Keep the branding.
But, you know, but,
keep
but
the branding.
Keep the brand name, but just completely make it the opposite of what, you know, it's George Bush with you know, only it's called Make America Great Again. And you see that. It's funny because, let me just say.
It's working.
What's her name? Yeah, it is working. Ivanka, the thing in the Kushner book saying about how Ivanka once says she sees it as the part of the start of a political dynasty. Well, of course it's going to be. I mean, if people think that first of all, the Trumps can't go back to real estate now. When Trump is out of office, you're going to see Mike Pence try to say, oh, you know, I'm like an even better version of Trump because I love the Jews even more than him, you know, and capitalism, you know, no more of that fair trade stuff, you know, that was holding our economy back. Or you're going to see at the same time, you're going to see the Trump family take it on and you're going to see Ivanka and they're going to take the legacy of this. And this will be the thing going forward. And that's why you see this realignment that a number of people have talked about. Andrew Anglin talked about it. You guys have been talking about it. The alignment of putting all these fake conservative figures as the false opposition, propping them up, corralling people into that. At the same time, I absolutely believe you're right about that.
I wouldn't be surprised if they create a new network or website or media outlet.
AmericaFirst.com or
with Trump branding, with actual, because remember, they were even talking about Trump TV as something that they might do if Trump lost. I would not be surprised if they do a Trump TV eventually. They actually literally brand it with his name, and that's this new Republican Party. And you know, it will ultimately morph back into basic bitch Zionism. Conservatives, well, I mean, not even basic bitch. Hyper Zionism.
That's what TPUSA really represents, is that kind of, you know, accuse your opponent of being a socialist, but at the same time support a massive military budget for Zionist wars. And then, you know, this kind of nonsense that's not really starting to it's not really growing any legs, but there you can totally see them trying to jam that back into the box.
So the thing I wanted to get to, we were talking about Israel and Gaza. So this the news exploded a couple of days ago with, oh God, four Jews killed by 600 rockets fired by Hamas from Gaza into Israel. Now, of course, when we talk about rockets, we're talking about like cylinders, pipes filled with gunpowder, homemade things that they fire in. These are not advanced rockets. These Qassam rockets. These are they basically make these by hand because they don't have any, you know, nations dealing big armaments to them the way Israel does. Also, this was a retaliatory attack by Hamas. The Israel struck first, and the Drudge Report did something very dishonest. Ryan Dawson had a great video on this. The Drudge Report put the explosion, the large explosion, from the Israeli bombs hitting Gaza, and then they put under it the headline, Hamas attacks Israel. And so this is what this is Israel's international PR, which is basically the entire U.S. media. Israel knows that they attacked first, and Hamas knows that the Jews attacked first, and that this was a retaliation. So it was an effective one because they hit, you know, they hit four targets. But this was not Hamas just randomly shooting rockets, which is what they would have you believe. So now there's some sort of ceasefire or whatever they've got.
It's so amazing how the principle that they use against us on a small scale, where they attack you and when you respond, you're the demon. They use that in geopolitics in the same fashion. It's remarkable.
It's how they are, man. They cry out as they strike you, and this became a saying for a reason. And it's not just remarkable. It actually is so enraging. It's like deeply, fundamentally inside my soul enraging to me. That it is actually something that motivated me when I started to see this around the time of Middle East strife in the early 2000s after 9/11 and the Iraq war and such, and see, this is what started me down the path to where I am now. And when I discovered, and I knew pretty early on this was a Jewish element doing this, I didn't understand the full scope of it, but this started me down the path, and I saw the hypocrisy, I saw the blatant lying, I saw the double standards. I saw the total lack of care, and just this. It's enraging. There's no other word for it.
Yeah, that's why. Like, some people might criticize me and saying that, oh, all you do is talk about Jews, blah blah blah. But show me whatever problems every other group has. Show me who can even be in the same league.
No,
I mean, because it's one thing to be a creature of instinct and just be violent for whatever reason, you know, that's what it is. But the sheer malice is what angers me. Yeah. That's that sheer malice, that relationship to the truth where someone says something to you and you just pretend not to hear them. Like, that's how Jews operate, and it's fucking sickening.
Yeah,
I'll tell you guys something funny about, you know, first of all, I totally agree that the thing of the injustice of what those people, what the Jews do, you watch on the, like, I was watching RT had a bunch of clips of the rockets actually hitting in Israel, or in Gaza rather, and it's, you can't imagine that kind of terror raining down on you, not knowing if it's, you know, how it's going to, if it's going to hit a school or what, you know. But I'll tell you something funny. I went, this was a number of years back, I went and protested AIPAC when they were meeting in full session. And I went down there with a friend of mine from college who is a Muslim guy who's very brown. And it was just him and me, the two of us. And we were old friends, you know. And we went down there, and I had a sign that was a dump Israel sign, but I also was wearing some like right wing paraphernalia, and he went down there with a Palestinian and an American flag, and we were going to join with some protesters, but they had already, I think, left for the day, the Answer Coalition people. So we went and we stood on a street corner, and as we stood there, the doors opened to AIPAC, and I guess they were like it was their lunchtime or something. But next thing you know, like thousands of Jews are pouring across the street at the crosswalk, looking at us standing there, and all, you know, giving us dirty looks, saying things. And I shit you not, this is the most amazing story. A Jew comes up to me because I think I had some Trump stuff on. And he said this to me. He starts talking to me, "Hey, man, why are you wearing that? Why are you standing there with that Muslim guy? Because, you know, I'm like, I support Trump too. I'm with you, man. We got to stand together against the Muslims, the Islamic threat." I mean, this is while like there's hundreds of Jews walking by, you know, and we're standing there, me and my Muslim friend, back to back. And this Jew is talking to me about this while he's having this conversation. Some leftist Jew starts talking to my friend and saying, literally, like, we have to, "Hey, man, why are you standing there with this white guy with the Trump stuff? We got to stand together against these white nationalists, these haters, the, you know, Trump and this white supremacy."
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
They were literally one Jew on one side, one Jew on the other, them trying to talk each other and really trying to, because they were both like, it really disturbed them. It shook them up that we were standing, you know, and I've known this guy for 15 years, so they're not going to divide us against each other. But they're both there making this, and both attend at AIPAC, and
that's why we have to watch out for any fractures we see, like whether it's man versus woman or woman versus man, or you know, young people talking shit about boomers or boomers shitting on the younger people. Listen, we're all guilty of it. There are contradictions that are inherent, but we have to make sure these ne'er-do-wells, these Zionists, these Jews, they can't break our unity. We have to make sure that we're immunized and that we know when we're being manipulated against each other and when, you know, the difference between that and white banter. We have to know that. And there has to be a hard line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they are constantly prodding. They're constantly prodding for weaknesses. And their number one weapon, because there's just not many Jews in the world, they can't be in power without causing mass class struggle. And I don't mean that in the economic sense, but class struggle in all the ways you can think of. Like now, it's not even just class struggle between women and men. Now you have like they're inventing new genders to divide people up even further.
Yeah, no, they have to create divisions and fractures, and they have to create sides and camps, and they have to get people fighting amongst themselves to maintain power. This is something we've seen. You know, we don't need to go much further with it, but this is what they do. And
how about Trump's endorsement though of this? I mean, just like Trump has pulled everything, you know, it's not just on Palestine and that, but on every issue. A number of people have made the point that Obama was actually better on issues like immigration and gun control. I mean, well, Trump is so cartoonishly bad right now. It's Jewish.
He's just so bad because what happened is, now you could argue on immigration, but Obama was better on immigration if that's true, because he just kept with the flow of how things,
status quo.
Status quo. What Trump did was he set up a fight on immigration, but then he didn't fight. So the left brought all their guns to bear, and then Trump just didn't show up for the fight. So they just rushed through. So they're like, "Oh, we've got to organize these migrant caravans. We got to organize this propaganda. We got to push people. We got to get all these NGOs. We got to activate all of our resources to get all of these, you know, Central and South Americans into America. We got to activate all resources to do that." And Trump's not even there to fight it on the other side. So his rhetoric inflamed them, and then they're just barreling through. And you know, of course, he's doing that thing. The classic conservative thing is the outlet is Israel, and only really now. I know you don't. Let's not divide by generation or whatever, but only really boomers fall for this, where they allow all of their whatever nascent nationalistic feeling they have to be filtered into feeling about Israel, and they're encouraged to do that. They're encouraged to do that by the media, by their churches, etc. And so Trump is now literally, if you listen to him talk about his accomplishments, it's all stuff he's done for Israel. And when you look at conservative punditry, they all talk about the amazing accomplishments for Israel and like refunding the military, getting tough on Iran, moving the embassy, everything else he's done. And now this whole bullshit jingoism on Iran, I know you got a point, Stryker, but I wanted to talk about the total unfeasibility of a successful.
Just a quick point I'd make about Trump is what I always say about him is that he's like the butt.
He's like the.
He's always talking shit to people. Like he's always going up to random people and like talking to their girl and shit talking the guy. And what do you do about it? But then when shit pops off, he's the first one to run away and leaves his friends with the fight. Like that's the kind of guy Trump is, and that's why I think that I'm glad a lot of people have jumped off the Trump train.
Dude, everybody's off
nothing
the train.
But trouble. He's been nothing but trouble. He's escalated the tension, and yet nothing but bluster behind that.
Yeah, but on some level, here's another thing I want to say on Trump, though. At some level, we gotta attack the guy. We gotta continuously attack the guy. We got to not cry in our cups over it either. It's over.
Right,
he's done.
Right.
Let's not feel pity and self. Let's not wallow in it. Like it's done. He is done. We fell for it to some extent, some more than others. I'm not denying I fell for it.
We got a lot of mileage out of him, though. We got a lot of mileage. He got a lot of mileage out of us. We got a lot out of him.
Well, you could close your eyes and cry all you want, but when you wake up tomorrow, it's still going to be the same way.
Exactly. Like, so what are we going to do?
You can accept it, deny it, or not, or engage it. So we have to just confront what we have, what's on the table.
So yeah, now,
Mike, this is what I was going to say. Let me just
With what you said about we got mileage out of Trump. With the conflicts were escalated, and all of this stuff. So we got our thing out of him, and he got out of whatever. But I'm not done. I'm not doing this self pity thing. Like, when is Trump going to do this? He's not going to. Okay, just assume that, and then what are we going to do?
Well, this is the thing I wanted to say, that the joke's on them, and this is what I was going to say before we took a little break, is that, you know, oh, yeah, you got us, you tricked us, you know, you turned MAGA back into neoconservatism, you got, you know, all this shit for the 1%, the Jewish billionaires, banks, more foreign wars, more immigration, all of it. You got us, boy, you got white America, you really pulled the fast one, but guess what? The things that led to Trump in the first place, the things that led to Obama beating Hillary in the first place, was the discontent among the people, and the rising politicization of the people is caused by the fact that these policies, these neoliberal policies, are making people's lives worse. And compared to the late 90s, when everybody was making money and it was still way more white than it is now, and people were still comfortable and they were totally checked out of politics. Compared to after the recession, after 9/11, after the Iraq War, after this huge sucking of wealth from the middle class to the top, and the impoverishment of everybody else, and then now the social fragmentation of everybody else, guys can't meet a decent girl, and fucking everybody's dying of drug overdoses. We're living in this crumbling dystopia, and that's the thing. You manage to keep the ruling class in power a little bit longer, but guess what? All the consequences are still going to catch up. The people are still going to be miserable. You can censor their opinions. Their lives are going to continue to suck. And unless that is fixed, which it's not going to be, but in the nature of the system, it devours itself. The hatred is going to grow anew from the people, and people are going to be looking for answers and questions. And we're going to be there to provide those answers and those questions, no matter how, you know, what they do to shut us down. So, you know, the joke's on them with all this censorship and bullshit.
Yeah, in the end. And as far as the I wanted to make one last point. As far as the jingoism against Iran, this move with this aircraft carrier crap that John Bolton does. Of course, John Bolton comes out and he makes his announcement. And some general countersignaled him. He's like, why would you ever do that? Like, this is a very unusual maneuver. And it's because it was some attempted some kind of flex, because there's this desire of the neocons to do these flexes. But we're really actually unprepared for engagement there. We're actually losing. The U.S. strategic, the U.S.-Israel strategic goals over there are not being met. So Syria, just yesterday, launched their final attack on Idlib, which is the final place where ISIS holdouts, the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia sponsored ISIS rebels against the Assad regime. The final holdout was in this northwestern province of Idlib up near Turkey. They had organized this sort of this truce there where Turkish troops were keeping the peace along with Syrians on the outskirts or whatever. That's over with. Turks have pulled out and the Syrians are going in and they're mowing them down. So then you start seeing this. So that's why there's new. This happens at the same time as this escalation in Gaza, at the same time as Bolton makes this threat against Iran, at the same time that Iran starts talking about they're going to pull out of the nuclear deal, which I love that the U.S. thinks that they have some sort of right now, that we have some sort of right to enforce this deal that we unilaterally pulled out of because of a, you know, big ball maneuver by Trump. So it's all kind of lighting up over there. But let me just tell you something. So in 2002, the U.S. did war games about a possible war against Iran. It was called Millennium Challenge 2002, and it was a total disaster. So just from reading from the Wikipedia, this is just, I'll close out with this, just to show you how totally unprepared. And imagine the U.S. military in 2002 versus U.S. military today. Think about the difference in the kind of personnel. The equipment, sure, but the personnel. So they did a war game, which was red versus blue, where red was Iran and blue was the U.S. So red, commanded by retired Marine Corps General Paul K. Van Ripper, adopted an asymmetric strategy, in particular using old methods to evade blue's sophisticated electronic surveillance network. Van Ripper used motorcycle messengers to transmit orders to frontline troops and World War II-style light signals to launch airplanes without radio communications. Red received an ultimatum from Blue, essentially a surrender document demanding a response within 24 hours. Thus, warned of Blue's approach, Red used a fleet of small boats to determine the position of Blue's fleet. By the second day of the exercise in a preemptive strategy, Red launched a massive salvo of cruise missiles that overwhelmed Blue's forces' electronic sensors, destroyed 16 warships. This included one aircraft carrier, 10 cruisers, 5 of 6 amphibious ships. An equivalent success in a real conflict would have resulted in the deaths of over 20,000 service personnel. Soon after the cruise missile offensive, another significant portion of Blue's Navy was sunk by an armada of small red boats, which carried out both conventional and suicide attacks to capitalize on Blue's inability to detect them. So they used the kind of strategy Iran would use against the U.S. if we attempted to invade them. And they defeated the U.S. Forces in one day in this war game.
Wow.
And this, now granted, it was a U.S. general that did this. But he was like, what would the Iranians do? And he did this. So then this was meant to be a two-week war game. So they suspended it. They suspended the exercise because Blue, which was the United States, suffered this horrifying... I mean, you imagine 20,000 service personnel defeated in a day for an already unpopular war. Do you know what that would do?
The end of America. Yeah. It would be literally
people
the end of America.
People would not know how to deal with that. And this is one of the reasons...
People would overthrow the government.
Yeah. This is one of the reasons that they're hesitant for this, because they know that this will happen. They cannot go up against Iran. It's a huge country of 80 million people. They will be motivated to kill our troops if we land in their country. It will make the Iraqi resistance look
we've been fucking with them for at least two decades now. So they have a lot of resentment built up.
Yeah.
And they're really trying their best to not get on our level. But it's going to get to a point where it's impossible, and they're just going to have to fight.
Yeah,
I mean that's the funniest something thing. We can all you know, people can call me anti-American for saying that, but we can all empathize with that feeling,
dude.
Knowing the power structure treats us
Remove your any emotional involvement with U.S. military success, which most Americans are there. They don't really give a shit, because no one believes. Now, everybody would love the troops if they felt they were actually fighting for us, but no one believes it. Nobody believes it. And when you see patriotards try and come out and like browbeat you with patriotarded rhetoric about fighting for freedom, it's a laugh. It's a fucking laugh. It's a joke. The idea. And look, I don't have anything against military personnel themselves, guys that signed up for whatever reason. Some of our best guys are those guys, but they know.
Yeah.
They know damn well that they didn't fight for America. They didn't fight for anything really.
They
fought for
they
Jews,
all know they
for
all
corporate
know.
Interests and Jewish interests, Zionism and corporations. They know that. They're all damn well aware of it. Even if they saw their buddies die, they're damn well aware that this is the case. So they don't have any sentimentality over this bullshit. In fact, it pisses them off. So this exercise that they did, they actually had to, it was supposed to be 14 days, but Blue lost in one day. And so they had to script the rest of the they reset and they redid it with a script, and which blew like wins an overwhelming victory. And then it was widely criticized by other people in the military establishment for being a fucking farce. And they didn't seem to have learned their lesson, which is these tactics that the Iranians would be likely to use, you know, not using sophisticated electronics, using land communications, using suicide attacks, small boat attacks.
Look at how Hezbollah defeated Israel.
Yeah, exactly.
In the 33 days.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They owned them.
The Gulf in military defensive military technology has gone has caught up with American doctrine and Israeli doctrine. So,
well, defensive
tactics. All these modern.
I mean, let me just say, with white America, I mean, when you look at the push with gun control and all that, it's because there's 200 million white people in the United States, and they have a lot of weapons. And I know, you know, we can say that, okay, well, white, you know, the gun people would never use them, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, if they really, you know, 2 million Jews sitting in Wall Street and Silicon Valley are not going to be able to hold down 200 million whites if it comes down to it. So, you know, it's really – it doesn't matter what their technological advantages are. It just – it doesn't matter. They're going up against people power on a level that's too big for them to handle.
Not for nothing, and I'm not saying this is my opinion, but if you're a real accelerationist, then you ought to be pushing for the United States to fight a war with Iran. That would be the end of the U.S. government.
It would be a major breaking point. And
it'll be the end. You know, part of the – something tells me that – one of the reasons they're so aggressive and cracking down on us lately is because they're pivoting towards a war in Iran, and they don't want us to run the anti-war movement.
Yeah, they know,
we will ride that shit to fucking political power.
I remember with the Iraq war, I mean, they were, and that's one of the things with that Farrakhan press conference. If you go back and watch it, he was laying out how far back they were laying the groundwork for the Iraq war. And I remember when I was a little kid watching Ahmed Shalabi on television on 60 Minutes, and 60 Minutes did like a puff piece about him.
Yeah.
And the man who was going to, and they were just, I mean, it took decades for that plan to mature. And then when it actually came to fruition, they screwed it up. I mean, they really did a terrible job.
Up this guy's balls for years.
Yeah, but I think with Iran, it's the same thing. I think they're sort of there's a momentum to this, and they're really taking their time. I don't think that Trump, maybe in Trump's second term, maybe if the economy starts to go bad or something, then it's time to start.
They've got a couple of persistent problems.
Yeah,
one is the U.S. public. Okay,
yeah,
and two, what Stryker said exactly right, that a new anti-war movement, we would be a significant component, if not the main component, the main energy behind it. The left has lost their anti-war energy. Now, with Trump as president, I think I could see a leftist anti-war movement emerging, which is another thing they might be worried about. Because, you know, I mean, I'm going to be anti-war no matter what. The left, particularly the mainstream left, will depends on who's president, right? But I could see a left-wing anti-war. Anyway, it would be very destabilizing. Also, it's not they're not going to be able to bowl over Iran like they did Iraq. It's too big. There's too many people. There's too many people that are very motivated to fight America. Too many people that are actually well-trained fighters, like the Revolutionary Guard, etc. They're not going to be able to do it. And like I said, these asymmetric tactics, they already war-gamed it and lost terribly. They didn't seem to have learned their lesson. And the U.S. military of today is not the U.S. military even of 2002.
No.
Okay, we have more non-whites. We have more weird sexual deviants. You know, they put women in charge of their, you know, they're doing all this politically correct crap. They're promoting women. They're promoting trannies. You know, it's just stupid. Okay.
At the same time, Mike, retarded. I would say though, the thing that you were saying about, I don't think that, like, I almost don't want to get people's hopes up that, I mean, even though that would be a terrible, horrible tragedy if they did something like that, I mean, on a scale that's difficult to comprehend. At the same time, from a political standpoint, I don't think Zog is, I mean, I don't think they're that stupid yet. I don't think they're that stupid yet to try to actually make it happen. I mean, I think that they would like to if they could, the same way they would like to have us all put in camps. But I don't think that they just can do it yet. It may come to pass down the line, but we certainly can't wait for it because I don't think they're going to – like I say, I don't think they're in a position to do it, and I just – they don't have the power to do it right now.
And I mean, look, when they go out and they saber rattle, like this. Now, this bluff with this aircraft carrier that was supposedly going there anyway as the other aircraft carrier leaves to come back to America, this was a routine change, and they made it like it was a big deal. But as they saber-rattle, if they're going to saber, like, we just continue, one, don't support it. Actively don't support it. Actively juke the narrative. Actively counter-signal. And particularly in right-wing and conservative circles. Because these people have no real way of defending this. They can't really stand up for it. And these people were all eagerly on board with Trump when it was anti-Syria's message. Now, the fact of us continuously characterizing Syrian opposition as ISIS and Islamic terrorists, that created a huge problem for them. They can't go out there and say with a straight face, democratic rebels. Everyone laughs at that shit. Mm-hmm. It's a joke. I mean, Trump actually said it to Hillary Clinton in one of the debates. That was remarkable. When he, again, another thing he said, she was trying to say, oh, these democratic rebels. And he was like, they're terrorists. We don't know who they are. I mean, the fact is we actually do know who they are. He didn't know who they were, but we do know who they are. They are terrorists. They are ISIS. And so continually to say that really makes a problem for them. They can't do their bit. Well, these democratic rebels. No, these are fucking jihadists. ISIS people. These are Wahhabists. These are Salafists. Right. The most reactionary form of Islam that they're using is their cannon fodder against these secular regimes. We know that. And a lot of people know that now. And they can't. We also know, like, you pulled out of this Iran deal. What the fuck? What, now you want to enforce it? Get the fuck out of here. I thought we pulled out. Right. This is a great narrative. Oh, Trump pulled out of the Iran deal. Isn't it great? Now we don't have to enforce it when Iran pulls out. Fantastic. We have no obligations.
What's the word of the United States of America mean if you're able to just pull out of deals and treaties and agreements
still
like
try
that?
And hold the other side to their end of
like,
it?
Why should anyone ever negotiate with the United States at all? I mean, don't people see the link between that and Kim Jong-un's ambivalence towards giving up his nuke?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Why should he? He sees what happened to Gaddafi or Saddam.
Oh, right. Exactly. I used to say that all the time. I remember right while they were talking about going into Iraq, Kim Jong-un's predecessor there, he was, you know, waving his nuke saying, hey, we got him. We're going to nuke, you know, California, you know, like he was so belligerent and aggressive with their and it's funny because the U.S. is just like, okay, well, we're going to go over here. And then, you know, Gaddafi is the ultimate example of a guy who works with Hillary Clinton, gives up his weapons, and then, you know, is sodomized to death with like a rusty knife, you know, by a bunch of savages in the desert. So, yeah, I mean, if Iran and that's the thing, by Trump breaking off the Iran deal, it actually Iran knows then it's on notice. We better prepare for real shit. We better, you know, get ready.
We can ride it like the left rode the Vietnam protests. That's what I'll say.
Yeah.
I do think that there's major hesitancy and there's cooler heads in the room. There are the insane people that want to do this, and they also ultimately want to cut off Russia from Iran. That's why they say they want their oil exports reduced to zero, because one of the places they export to is Russia. Now, we currently can't do anything about that because we don't have a – which is also another reason for some of this Ukraine business, because if we establish a, you know, control there, then the shipping lanes between those two countries – but it's all bullshit. The thing about this stuff is it's sort of fascinating and interesting, but it doesn't – Americans are not going to in any way be helped by these wars. There's no sense that we're fighting for any interest of our own. We're not fighting for our homeland. We're not fighting for a vital interest of our country. We're not fighting even for an ally. I mean, Israel is not – these people they are more than happy to use up and spit out the USA and move on to something else if that's what they have to do. They don't give a fuck. They don't have any nostalgia for this country. They don't care. It's a tool. And so that's why they will besmirch our good name. They will make our leaders and our country look like assholes and fools and villains on the world stage. And they will ultimately destabilize our whole economy and use up all our military assets.
And
they're happy to do it because they don't give a fuck.
And again, people can call me a cuck for this or whatever, but we also have to make sure that the Islamic world knows that it's not white people doing this shit, because imagine it from their perspective. They already kind of know, but like, we need more people to be reaching out to the Iranians, to the Syrians, to the Lebanese, all these people that are victimized by our Zionist government. We need to talk to them and be like, listen, these people are killing us too. So don't blame us. You know, if you're going to aim your – I'm not saying anyone should do any terrorism or anything. But if you guys are going to be – you know, do Islamic attacks on someone, you know not to aim for normal white people, because ordinary white people have no say over their government.
That's what they want. They want us fight. I mean, Mike, you made that point here recently. You've been talking a lot about this supposed, you know, Muslim radical who wanted to bomb a white nationalist. You know, and that's clearly the direction they're going to go. And you know, it is a little spooky. It is a little spooky because you have to think, if I were Zog, what would I do? And that's perfect. That's brilliant. You know, stage a bomb a white nationalist event and then say it was Islamic radicals, and that way you start them fighting amongst themselves. And then, you know, then you could do the same thing to Muslims, and then, oh, well, we need to ban them both, you know, like Farrakhan and Alex Jones. We need to outlaw both these dangerous terrorists. But, yeah, it's something that, let me ask you guys this. Do you think that – I think that based on just the lessons of World War II, I don't think that they will risk a war with Iran or anybody else, a major war – until there is a major economic downturn or there's some other crisis that they need to have us get us all on board with some new thing. Do you think that if you had to bet, would you say that the next big thing is it going to be another foreign policy engagement, another war, or is it going to be a big economic downturn? Which is going to come first?
Well, frankly, I don't see how the current economic boom could be sustainable. It's all done on a kind of cloud of finance. So right. Like that's going to collapse at some point. I think the immigration problem may be a kind of hidden time bomb. You're going to see a lot of these illegal aliens that are pouring into the country in record numbers, far more than under the Obama era. That might be a ticking time bomb. But then also the war. I mean, there are so many different things that could take down the U.S. government. And I think that 5 years from now, politics are going to look so radically different. We won't even know how to expect what's in the near future. But I think there's, you know, the system as it is right now is totally unsustainable. And whatever they think of Trump, I guarantee and I promise the Jews listening to this, I promise you that one day you will look back on Trump with nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because when we take power and we're going to take power, you're going to be sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. I think the U.S. is destabilizing and fracturing along a number of lines. There's no there's no steady hand at the obviously the Trump's hand is not steady, but the hand of the people controlling him is not steady either. There's no place you can look to for comfort and stability. The economy is clearly a bubble. On top of that, they can give you all the stats that they want. That doesn't mean there aren't people out there doing day labor gig jobs. So they could say, oh, look, the unemployment's great. But yeah, but these are day labor gig jobs. These are low wage, no security jobs.
Yeah, they're driving Uber.
These are not jobs that are going to move you forward in life. They're jobs that let you pay your rent for the next month. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Like I got to catch up on bills. I got to take this job. So it's not, these aren't careers. These aren't stable positions. These aren't fulfilling positions. These are increasingly unstable wage jobs. Wages aren't, they've gone up a little bit. But what would really spur a wage increase would be an actual closure of the border to new entry of foreign labor would be disallowed, would actually start increasing wages. As soon as we got to the point where that might start happening, boom, this massive flood happened. So, look, the government's exposed, even the military. We have this military that's half of the world's military budget in total. You know, the rest of the world spends as much as we do. And they can't accomplish their military goals. I mean, Syria, there's one province in Syria, and they're bitching because the Syrians are just going to take it back. And they can't do anything because, one, the will of the people isn't there, but they also don't have confidence in their ability to project this overwhelming force. And it would, you know, it's, they can't take on Iran. They can saber rattle and try and bring Iran back to the table to like cuck out or something, but at some point the Iranians are going to call the bluff, and I think that's what they're coming, and that's what's approaching. And you know, if you want the United States to go in to battle with a country like that, It could win. We could win. But it would be a Pyrrhic victory, and the people wouldn't be supporting it. I mean, the United States is not prepared to sustain 20,000 casualties in a war that nobody cares about.
The Iranians are used to austerity. They're used to embargoes. They're used to the kinds of sacrifices you have to make during a war. Americans are not.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that maybe that's a big part of the shutting down? Like, if you look at Alex Jones and Farrakhan, you know, it's anticipating further. I mean, I think you mentioned that earlier, but it occurs to me the idea of 9/11. I mean, I'm not a 9/11 truther. I'm not. I'm sorry, but like, and I know every time I say that, exactly people are like, "Well, let me show you this. Let me show you this stuff." You know, but,
I know exactly where you're going with this. Yeah.
Well, so many people, so many Americans. It's shocking. They do polls. The amount of, I mean, Americans have a very conspiratorial, you know, maybe it comes from our roots with, you know, with distrusting the British crown or whatever. But we have
also because the fucking media is constantly lying to people.
Well, yeah. Gulf of Tonkin and Pearl Harbor and everything going back the Lusitania. Americans know, you know, that they're the media and the government lies to them. But I feel like these are prominent voices with huge audience. I mean, imagine if Alex Jones still had his whole YouTube thing, which would be much bigger now. And if they were talking about doing something with Iran or Venezuela, I mean, we haven't even touched on Venezuela. But, you know, either one of them, I feel like the level of cynicism of people is
incredibly
so
frustrating
high.
To them that they have not been able to get the right wing on board, or the shall we say, if you don't like right and left, the people that traditionally vote Republican, they have not been able to get them on board for this stuff. Ever since Iraq, people have wised the fuck up, and they, in fact, people like war polls lower among people that vote Republican than people that vote Democrat, at least as of like last year. So they are like, what the fuck? And Alex Jones is a big part of that. We're a big part of that. Antiwar.com
Tucker
and others
is a big
like
part
that.
Of it.
Tucker is a big Tucker. There's a lot of
Tucker is the biggest. Tucker is the biggest part of that.
He really
right. But
I was personally pleasantly surprised when I saw him come out against the invasion of Venezuela. He really put there was some Cuban guy, some Cuban politician from I think he's Cuban from Florida, a Republican of course. He was trying to pitch the war in Venezuela to his GOP audience, the largest on cable news, of course. And Tucker was just ripping him to shreds. He was just like, this guy is such a fucking huckster, used car salesman. And Tucker's like, well, how does America benefit from this?
And every day and that Tucker's also, on, yeah, every day that Tucker's on, he moves people past more in his – in other words, we all know they're trying to get him rid of him, but each night that he's on – the people that he reaches grow a little more immune to the, you know, to being bamboozled later on, and it becomes, and the stronger he's getting, he's growing stronger. So, you know, when they try to remove him over some fake controversy, it's going to look so obvious. You know, each night that he's on, his strength grows. So, yeah, he's a real problem for them.
Yeah, he's one of their biggest problems. I wouldn't say he's totally responsible for the anti-war sentiment, but that's irrelevant. I mean, who's
that's why he's popular is because he's channeling it. He's channeling what's already Jones, there, and that's why he's popular.
Jones was a big part of it. Libertarian activists, you know, whatever you want to say about some of their other views, they were very staunch on this, and they continue to keep this alive on the right, and also just the people themselves are just like, this is garbage. Like, the Iraq War was extremely unpopular within a few years, and it's just like people still remember that, and 9/11 truth as a thing. More people are 9/11 truthers, if you will, than not. More people believe some kind of conspiracy narrative than believe the official narrative, and whatever we might think, a lot of what they believe is really dumb, holograms and whatnot, but or no planes and things like that. But it's a thorn in their side. It's a problem for them
because they cannot mention the gun grab shit. Like whenever there's a mass shooting, you always get the false flag. It's out there.
Yeah, exactly.
In a sense, it might be stupid, and we might think, oh, that's like a lowering of our discourse or whatever. But the reason is that the false flaggets are more believable than the mainstream media.
Oh, they are.
Because if people, for whatever their faults are, people, the average person accurately senses that the people on the, in the media that interpret the mass shootings for you are just trying to conspire to make you give up guns.
So they it's like the Notre Dame Cathedral. The Notre Dame Cathedral. I mean, this fucking thing is burning. It's still flaming on fire, and they're like saying, "Oh well, we know for sure it wasn't arson. That we've ruled that out. We've ruled that out." I mean, the same people, there's like 800 fires in different churches around France, and the same people lying about all this Muslim crime, you know, Christmas markets with guys, you know, screaming Allah Akbar, ramming buses through Christmas markets. And then the largest, I mean, you know, one quick thing about that. I wanted to say this. I was having a conversation with my father about this, and we were talking about Notre Dame and the cathedrals. And I really, we were talking about how Christian civilization, or not Christian civilization, Germanic civilization, civilization proper, really started among the Germanic Northern European peoples in the medieval age. And there is no greater temple.
Are you talking about feudalism?
Well, yeah. There is no greater.
Feudalism. Here's what
feudalism. Let me just say this. I just want to say this. The thing is, I just want to say this. The Notre Dame Cathedral to the Germanic whites of the world is like our pyramids. That is the greatest. Those cathedrals are the greatest monuments to the northern European Germanic civilization. And so to see that cathedral burning and to see these Muslims, you know, in Paris, and again, we've been talking a lot of pro-Muslim, this is an anti-Muslim thing, the Muslims in Paris, you know, overrunning it. But for the media and the system and Macron and all the rest of them to come out screaming about how it was not arson and shutting down everybody on Fox News, pulling the plug, like literally while people are trying to talk about it, it's like, you think, I mean, even if it wasn't arson, which I believe it was, but even if it wasn't, what does that say about your credibility with the people that they suspect that you are covering it up? The French government is covering this up. What does that say about how you've lost the trust of your own people? And that goes back to what we're talking about with 9/11. What does it say about the trust that people have in Congress, in the media, in their institutions? That, like you said, more people are 9/11 truthers than are not.
Yeah. Well, look. Well,
one point I was going to make just now is that feudalism itself was an application of a Germanic head on a Greco-Roman body. And what do I mean by that? It brought in the principles of divine kingship, which are a Germanic principle, not a Roman one, into the Europe-wide consciousness, and those cathedrals were a kind of representation of this Western universalism. And I mean it within the European context in the sense that, you know, you can find Christian cathedrals of this sort everywhere from Spain to Norway down to France. And so what it means really is an attack on Western civilization as a whole when you see that thing burning. You know, I find that it's very much something that they know could provoke not a crusade per se, but a civilizational shock into a
wake-up call.
It did.
Yeah.
And you saw how their reaction to it was a reaction to us.
Yes.
If you look at how they talked about it in the press, they were complaining, and then they were reacting to us, and they were saying the alt-right managed to insert themselves into this discussion and make this a discussion about what this represents. Like, they wanted to say, this is going to be a new thing representing global homo, and then we got in the way of that. And like I said, if you think we're irrelevant, we can finish on this note. If you think we're irrelevant, why is the New York Times running a front page story on Sunday about the dialogue or the battle, the joust between Jewish medieval scholars or Jewish influenced medieval scholars in the academy and the alt-right about what European history means?
Right.
I mean, it's white, and they want to remove that, and the article is acknowledging that it's white, but then saying that's a problem for the narrative, what we make of that becomes a problematic narrative. So they are like, we need to develop a new discourse around medievalism. But no, we don't. You people just need to all be fucking run out of the academy on your hind legs. You know? Why don't we get medieval on these medieval scholars and fucking torches and pitchforks and get them out?
Why are they teaching a course about a people they hate. That's another thing. Well, yeah. Like, why?
Would you ever let me teach a course on Judaism?
Yeah, why don't
me and
you?
Stryker, well, we're going to teach you a course.
I mean, we do teach a course on it. I mean, that's something remarkable that I think, you know, to end on this, this is something that Tucker always talks about, how the elites today hate the people they rule. Mm-hmm. And it's only a matter of time before that blows up in your face. If you're going to teach a subject, if you're going to teach a people's heritage, but you hate those people, they're just going to fucking get angrier when you talk to them about it. So this is something to keep in mind. It's a great white pill. We will win in the end. It's just a question of how long it's going to take, but we're going to win in the end. It's inevitable.
And like Goebbels said, this Jewish insolence has lasted longer in the past than it will in the future.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. All right. So thanks, Stryker. Thanks, Ahab. And
thank you guys for having me on. It was a real honor.
Of course. I hope that the audience enjoyed this show. There was a little bit of people got a little eager to make their point and perhaps maybe a little yelling and talking over. But I think it was overall a good show. So I hope everyone enjoys it. And we will see you next week on Strike and Mike. I'll see you tomorrow on Tedious. Listen to the People's Square. Any other plugs?
Ahab.
You know what? I just started a podcast, A Briefing with Ahab. Actually, last night was my first one. It's just me rambling on about the news, but I put it up on YouTube, and I'm going to try to throw stuff out there a little bit more often.
All right. So check that out, and thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time. See ya.